Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about student loan debt. Yes, all of that trillion plus dollars that the next generation's been saddled with as we've redistributed wealth, well, from the future generations to our current billionaire class. Yay, big fun for that. So we're going to talk about that and what it means to the country to have the younger, the next generation, the ones who are going to be taking care of me when I'm old and decrepit and no longer able to take care of myself and my whole generation. What's that going to mean? What's it going to mean to their standard of living and their children? What's it going to mean for the future? Well, it's going to mean bankers are going to get wealthier and, well, the rest of us, well, good luck. Also on the program, we're Popeless. That's right, Popeless today. And someone tried to sneak in as a fake bishop to try and have an extra vote to see, well, which way the church will go. But as of today, Popeless, and I still don't understand why from the day he decided I'm leaving, didn't they have their little conclave and start blowing smoke? Just a thought. Also on the education front, more big money pushing for privatization while destroying our public institutions of learning. You just look at the latest teacher contract in Philadelphia, just another shot in the back at public education. And as while we speak, a big conference down in Texas where the privatizers are showing off their latest wares. We're going to talk about that. Also, corporate profits through the roof, wages in the tank, CEO pay, well, a whole different strata. But someone is doing something about it around the world. We'll talk about that. And the weekend bobbleheads were... we're out. Johnny Boehner, oh, the revisionist history. We'll talk about his stint on Sunday. And, of course, the president may have tipped his nerdiness hand, evidently a little too much knowledge of Star Wars, the books. Didn't bother to see. He's not a real American. He actually read the books. Can you believe it? Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. This past weekend, Keystone Progress, as we promoted all last week, Keystone Progress held their Pennsylvania Progressive Summit, looking to move the state forward, looking to do some things to get us back on the road, rebuild our roads and bridges and talk about community and talk about, you know, the direction of the nation. And I enjoyed the time there and all the folks who I met and who had conversations with. Thank you. I had taken my daughter, and it's, for some reason, she's just like me when I was a kid. This stuff fascinated me when I was a kid. Maybe because, you know, like when I used to deliver the newspaper from the time I was 8 all the way up until I was in high school, I delivered the newspapers. So I would read it. And the reality is I was probably better informed than most adults throughout my younger years. And I would read the different stories. And when I was a kid, the Iran thing was front and center news. So something like this would have been really just mind blowing to me. And my daughter really enjoys going to these things, and for a couple reasons. Gets to spend a little time with Dad and gets to see Dad in a more professional light. Oh, because she actually said to me, and it stopped me in my tracks. She goes, you know, I really had fun. We had lunch together, and, you know, I got to see my dad as a rock star. Because, you know, there was constantly people coming over, hey, I listen to the program, love it, love the work you're doing. And for me, you know, it's an opportunity to come every night and we talk about issues and we talk about things that are important, which is why I think these summits that Keystone Progress has done over the years are so important. And it does provide an opportunity for people to network and talk. And it's like this program, you know, on a shorter level, you know, shorter periods of time. It's a place to go and talk out ideas and do these things. And, you know, one of the things that there are a couple of moments over the weekend that I really took great pride in. With my daughter, because, you know, my first job is to raise that next generation, to make her self-sufficient, make her independent, make her a critical thinker, make her be able to deal in society and, you know, shape her world. And I was pleased at the number of people who said, hey, you know, it's fantastic that you're bringing your 10-year-old to these things. And, you know, she seems to really grasp and enjoys it and all this. And I was happy that there were only a handful of people who questioned, well, why is she here? Because, you know what? She's going to be the next generation who's going to lead this country, hopefully in the right direction. And, you know, there were some real world lessons to be had there. Like, for instance, we went to one of the first sessions that they had was called Women on Top. And yes, I know there's some double entendre there, but this was about, you know, women in positions of elected office and positions of power and, you know, how they got there. And I thought it was a perfect opportunity for my daughter to take a look at these people and go, hey, you know what? There are women out there who are doing things. It's not all men. There are women who are authoritative. There are women who are take charge. And that's a good thing for her to see. I think all of her, my daughter's generation needs to see that they can. They can be that next generation of leaders, the kind of leaders that I would love to see. So it was an excellent opportunity there. And then later on, we went to another one on messaging. And, you know, I got to, you know, use a little bit of my expertise because we got thrown into groups. So my daughter was able to see how dysfunctional a group can be. We got some real world learning experience out of, you know, how to operate within a group and in our group, how not to, because in the group we were in, we had the guy, the definitive expert, and, you know, like most things, you've got folks who, when you're in a small group, you've got to have people who are willing to relinquish leadership. And everybody at this conference, there are people who are leaders in their areas. These are the activists from across the state who are going to go back and hopefully do some organizing so we can change this world. But, you know, in groups like this, you have to have someone who's willing to sit back and go, okay, well, you direct it and we'll all come along. That didn't happen in our group. We got hung up in all different things, and our topic was fracking, and, you know, whatever your thoughts were was part of the argument on every discussion. We had the guy who wrote the definitive paper on fracking, the woman who was just her position on it was no, the other person who really didn't know anything about it because it wasn't in her area, and we spent most of the time just arguing over it. And it gave me a great opportunity to look like a hero in front of my daughter when I stood up, and nobody else wanted to give a presentation because we didn't have anything. And, you know, to go through and to do what I do here on the program every night, which is you identify what the problem is. You talk about the solution. What's the solution? How do we get to the solution? And what should people be doing to get there? So I just, you know, I was able to stand up and do that in a very natural way, which made me look good to my kid. And, you know, that made me happy. But beyond that, it gave her that real world experience of, you know, you need someone who's going to take charge. You need someone who's going to take responsibility. And, you know, just the idea of just in writing or thinking, it gives her an ability to, down the road, maybe be a little bit ahead of her peers. And I was extremely grateful that she took time with me and wanted to. It wasn't something that Dad came up and said, you're going with me. She was like, you know, you're going? I'd like to come too. And absolutely. I'm going to encourage my kids to do anything that they want or anything that they don't necessarily want to do with me. But, you know, if they want to come, by all means, we're going to do this. But the thing that gets me, and I was thinking about this, you know, from that seminar on the way to Way to Work this morning. And, you know, you think about these groups and how everybody has their ability to, you know, their special interests, their thoughts. And that's kind of how I view this program, as an opportunity for people to say, here's an issue. And I'll tell you what's important to me. I'll tell you the solutions that I have, how I think we can get there. But it's more about what you think as well. How do we get to the better world? How do we get to the so-called promised land, where I think all of us agree? I think where we disagree is the course of action, the path may be taken, or the policy, or if there is no policy. Because some people, you know, I've got friends who believe government should do nothing. And I've got people who think government should do everything. I'm somewhere right around the middle. I think we do what we can for ourselves, collectively. And the things that we don't and don't want to, you leave that to private industry. I think healthcare is something we can do for, health insurance is something we can do for ourselves. I think building roads and bridges and infrastructure and education, those are things we can do for ourselves. We don't need profit motives to get us to do this. It's all important to us and we should be doing it. But it gives me this idea that, you know, this is where I want to be hashing out these, almost like a support group, almost like a, you know, this is where we bounce ideas. Because there are so many things that need to be done. There are so many things that aren't being done. And when I go to these summits, I see so many people who know so much. And I wish it were a longer summit. I wish it was the whole weekend, because there were so many of the breakout sessions that I would have liked to have gone to. Because, look, at the end of it, while we may know a little bit about a lot of things, we don't know everything about each thing. And that's why I thought it was important. These things are important, which is why I had folks telling folks come out all last week, because I thought this was, and it was, there were more than 600 people there. The room was packed, and it was an amazing opportunity to have like-minded people in the same room. And I had a couple of people say, this is just people, preaching to the choir. And I'm going, well, yeah. The right wing does a masterful job of staying on message. Problem is the left, we have our little silo and we stick to our little issue, but as a broad base, maybe not as much. So it's good to network and it's good to talk about things and come up with a vision. A progressive vision for this nation, so that when my daughter's generation grows up and they take the reins, we're on that path. We're in that direction. I mean, there are so many things that I would like to see. And like I said, later on the program, we'll talk about student loan debt. I don't think we should be saddling the next generation with massive amounts of debt just so that they can be within the middle class range, so that they can make a living. There's something ridiculous about that, especially when we know that education benefits society as a whole. So what do we do as a matter of policy? What do we do as a matter of we the people to make sure that that next generation gets the education that we as a nation need them to have without saddling them with the responsibility? And I argue that what we've seen over the last 30 years is a massive redistribution of wealth from working families to the very wealthy, because they've walked away from that. And you look here in Pennsylvania, the amount of money going towards education, K-12 and higher ed, at historic lows. The fact that K-12, the state puts in 15% of the money for education, down from more than double that just a decade and a half ago, is ludicrous. And it does. It is that redistribution of wealth that we've been talking about. So over the next couple hours, we're going to be talking about the problems, some of the things that came up at the Keystone Progress Pennsylvania Progressive Summit. Going to take your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, join in on the discussion. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Politicians spent most of the weekend trying to shift blame for who was responsible for a series of drastic cuts that went into effect on Friday, known as the sequester. President Barack Obama was required to sign the $85 billion in cuts, and as he did, he called them dumb and arbitrary. The impact of the cuts will likely be felt for months and could be inflamed as Congress gears up for a budget debate this month. The president said he isn't interested in making deals month by month, a strategy that has been aggressively employed by the Republican House over the last 4 years, but is instead seeking a long-term but balanced approach. The intensity of the sequester fallout will depend on where one lives. Here's a roundup of what different regions are projecting. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Sunday that his state is already feeling the impact of the sequester, and a great deal of that is the psychological fallout from political brinkmanship. The direct impact in New York will include a loss of $42.7 million for primary and secondary education. That could see 590 teachers and aides out of work. Nearly 4,300 children will be impacted by necessary cuts to Head Start programs. Seniors in the state will lose out in nearly $1.5 million in meals. Pennsylvania is losing $37.5 million in federal funding to a number of housing programs. Loss of funding to one Pennsylvania program, the tenant-based rental assistance program, will directly affect more than 4,000 families. In Wisconsin, $10.1 million in federal funding is being lost in the state's Education for Children with Disabilities program. That state's university system will likely lose $35 million in research funding. California will see $62.9 million slashed from special education programs. 10,000 college work-study programs will be lost. The unemployed will also be hit with a setback in the quest for gainful employment, as $3 million in unemployment support will be eliminated.
The AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today released a joint statement on shared principles concerning immigration reform. Those principles include that Americans should have first crack at available jobs, but that laws permit businesses to hire foreign workers without going through a cumbersome and inefficient process to do it when needed. The Labor Federation and the Chamber say the challenge is to create a mechanism that responds to the needs of business while also fully protecting the wages and working conditions of U.S. and immigrant workers. The two organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but their joint statement says the nation needs to fix the immigration system in part by establishing a professional bureau in a federal executive agency with political independence to inform Congress and the public about immigration issues.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers.
What they do, they smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Yeah, they believe in teachers, especially the ones they can exploit. Those are the ones they love the most, yes. The ones that can work 80, 90 hours a week, and then they burn out after a year or two or three, and then they just bring in somebody else that they can work 90 hours a week. At least that seems to be what they're telling me. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Interesting New York Times article talking about the big money going into private education, into this whole voucher thing, the privatization of education. Evidently, this woman, Kate Anderson, is a candidate for the Los Angeles School Board, and they're saying there's a boatload of money coming into a school board race, some $44 million. Going into these school board races. And what New York Times pointed out is last month, Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, he donated $1 million to a coalition formed by the Los Angeles mayor with the explicit intention of getting candidates elected that will support the current superintendent and the policies that he's promoted. You know, the people like Students First, Michelle Rees' group, they've donated about $250,000 to the same cause. And the article goes into all of the other big money being pushed at this. So like my old man always said, you know, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. And that's why I'm saying education, that's the hill we have to die on. And you look at this contract that the Philadelphia School District has offered the teachers in that area. Oh, this is the shot in the back heard round the classroom, which is why I've asked Ron Whitehorn, a retired Philadelphia teacher, to come talk to us about what's going on there in Philly. Ron, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how are you?
I am good. I'm looking at all of these reports from across the country of all of this money going into vouchers and going into profitizing education, and I see this contract in Philadelphia almost as a we're going to force you into going out on strike. We're going to force you into pushing people out of the ranks. How do you see what's been going on there?
Well, this is the most devastating contract proposal I've ever seen. It would basically take the union back to 1965. It virtually wipes out all the gains of 50 years of organizing and going on picket lines and working at the bargaining table. It's really devastating. And what it is it's an attempt to solve the district's fiscal crisis, which is real. The district, over the next 5 years has a $1 billion plus deficit. And the plan is to solve this on the backs of and their students.
Yeah, I absolutely see that. And every time I see these reports come out, all of the money that's going into to defunding education. And you know, I look at the Chester Upland School District quite often as that that model for what they're trying to propose, which is, you know, taking money from public education, putting it into the hands of these charter operators, huge consulting fees for the well-to-do, while defunding public education. This is the area that the wealth class has identified as where they need to take over, not from just a profit standpoint, but from a control standpoint. When you look at this and you go, well, you know, here's the reality. They control the curriculum. They control what's being taught. And I look at this report out of Milwaukee, where the state Supreme Court justice raised something like $20,000 from these pro-voucher people. And, you know, the DeVosses and the Waltons, you know, for a court race. It's ridiculous. But getting back to Philadelphia and looking at this contract, which I view as a major slap in the face, 13% pay cuts, 13% increase in the cost of benefits, as you've pointed out, taking you back to 1965, I don't know how you make that offer without assuming that there's going to be a strike or something going on.
I think what they hope will happen is that they will drive out all the high seniority teachers, because what they're doing, the pay cuts are largest for the
people
the teachers at the highest steps.
Right.
They also want to completely eliminate step increases, and there's to be no raise at all till 2017. And that's to be negotiated based on some yet to be developed performance criteria. So yeah, it's clear that they hope to save a lot of money by doing this. And it's important to recognize they haven't lifted a finger to bring in new revenue for the district to address this fiscal crisis. State Senator Vincent Hughes pointed out today that the only demand they've made of Harrisburg is for $15 million in additional funding, which just happens to coincide with what Tom Corbett says he's prepared to give Philadelphia.
And you look at how the state has walked away from public education. You know, in this last budget, number I saw was 15% of the cost of public education the state is kicking towards it. And you look historically, that is probably an all-time low.
Yes, it is. It's clear that the objective from the state standpoint is to promote privatization of public education, particularly in the urban inner cities. And that's what's happening. This contract, along with the current round of school closings, as you know, they're going to close 29 schools. They're going to vote on that this Thursday. That's going to accelerate the move to charter schools.
And this is, again, you know, I go back to the whole model that's being perfected in Philadelphia for our listeners and in our listening areas. It's coming to our area. They're just perfecting the model in Philadelphia and in places like Cleveland and Milwaukee and Detroit and in the inner city urban areas, because they can right now. As soon as they get the foothold, as soon as they get that kind of power and control, it's going to spread to all parts of the state, all parts of the country. And then, well, then education will be controlled by the very wealthy and for very direct means as well, Ron.
Right. You're absolutely right. Here we have something called the, Philadelphia School Partnership, which is funded by the Gates Foundation and others of that ilk, and they're controlling a huge pot of money that's supposedly to go to school, good schools, regardless of whether they're parochial, charter, or public. Well, of course, all the money so far has gone to parochial, private, and charter schools, except for one grant to a public school, which was a magnet school. So basically, neighborhood schools, traditional public schools, which are hubs of community life, are being starved.
And again, you look at the creation of a crisis. I mean, this is what they've done. They've created this crisis. And I go back to what Milton Friedman said. It's the ideas that are lying around that get used when a crisis happens, whether it's, you know, one that is a natural means like what happened in New Orleans, or one that's being created like what we've been seeing for the last, 15, 20 years in Philadelphia?
Right. Shock and awe. That's what it's all about.
And, you know, I understand that, you know, down in the York City School District, there's going to be a push to charterize the entire school district there.
Yeah, I mean, it's with each move they make that succeeds, they're emboldened to try more.
You know, I have a friend who's a retired teacher, and she said, you know, back when we didn't have the right to collective bargaining, back when they needed little Johnny or Susie to bring in an apple because that was going to be their lunch for the day. Everyone loved the teachers, but as soon as teachers said, you know, we'd like to buy our own apple, please, or maybe a pear, that's when the assaults began.
Right. I feel somewhat optimistic about how the tide's running in terms of public opinion here in the city. There's been a lot of support for the effort to stop the school closing fight, and there's been a pretty big outcry about these contract proposals. So I think if we do the right thing, if we really educate the public, if we really mobilize and organize union folks, we can defeat this.
Can we? Will we see what transpired in Chicago? Do you think the Philadelphia Teachers Union and the teachers there can pull off what they pulled off in Chicago?
I think it will be difficult, but I think yes. If the will's there, I think we can do it. And I think the PFT has taken some positive steps. It played a leading role in terms of organizing PCAPS, this labor community coalition that's putting forward a progressive vision of school reform, fighting the school closings, and I think there has to be a lot more emphasis on mobilizing the rank and file, but hopefully that will happen. There's also been some strong support from other unions, so we'll see.
And, of course, you're going to have to get the parents and the community involved as well, because it is that outreach to the community. It is the education process. And it is that central part of the community that, you know, when I was a kid growing up in a housing project, it was the school that was the center of our community. It was where where everybody came to play and to be educated and so many things. And we're seeing that destroyed daily, I think.
Right. And I think we have a strong foundation here to organize parents and students as well, because these are attacks on students' learning conditions. If the most experienced teachers are driven out of the system, if teachers lose prep time and have to do yard duty and lunch duty, if class size is allowed to soar, that's going to impact the quality of learning.
Yep.
And that's the message we have to bring to the community. I don't feel any need to apologize for saying teachers should have a decent living wage. But fundamentally, this is about much more than that. This
Yep.
is about the quality of education for working class children. This is about the future of public education, which is a central democratic institution. So I think that's the way we have to frame this battle.
It's a protection of education for everyone. And I've been saying, you know, the working class of this country fought and bled for too long to get the right to an education, a free, compulsory public education. I would hate to see it stolen away.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And this is also I think we have to recognize that this is an attack on people of color and on the promise of the Civil Rights Revolution. I mean, this is taking the Brown decision with its promise of equal education for all and turning it on its head. We have less and less equity in our system. As people said in Chicago, they're developing a system of educational apartheid. You know, one system of schools for the privileged and the affluent, and then another system for everybody else.
Yeah. Well, some of the other things that I found in the contract to be the proposal to be quite interesting. My favorite one, I guess, is this the right to defend yourself, to use reasonable defense. And I thought about it in terms of the NRA's running around saying we should be arming teachers, putting guns in the hands of teachers, yet now the Philadelphia School District is saying that, that teachers can't reasonably defend themselves.
Right, right. Well, that's upset a lot of teachers. That language was just one in the last contract. So now it's on the way out. And there's lots of language that's being stripped from the contract that's been in there a long time, like the district's obligation to provide materials, the district's obligation to provide a lounge with water so that teachers can have a drink during the day.
Yeah, heaven forbid we want teachers to be hydrated or with materials to teach the children.
Right.
Heaven forbid.
And, you know, the district's response to that is, well, that doesn't mean we're going to dispense with these things. But Philadelphia teachers have every reason to be skeptical, particularly in the midst of a fiscal crisis, that that's exactly what will happen. I mean, right now, teachers spend on the average over $1,000 a year to provide materials because they don't have enough paper. Paper's like gold in schools.
Something
they don't have pencils. They don't have the basic things that you need to teach a lesson.
Something seriously wrong with it. So what do we do? What can we do to help? What's the answer here?
Well, as I said, I think we really have to get the message out about what this contends for labor, because of course this is not an isolated attack. This is part of a more general assault on public employee unions in particular and the labor movement as a whole. So we have to get that message out there. As we've been saying, we have to talk about the impact this has on the quality of education for students and working class families. And we have to convince our own teachers that we have to stand up. We can't just, you know, quit and file our resume someplace, because this isn't going away.
Yep.
It's gonna spread, and this is a time to make a real fight.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Ron Whitehorn, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the information.
Always a pleasure, Rick, and take care of yourself.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
America for the better.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The word of the day is boom. Yes, boom times are upon us again. The stars came into alignment, marveled one financial manager. Corporate confidence returns, applauded a recent headline. We're finally dusting off the cobwebs, rejoiced a business analyst, pointing out that banks are willing to take risks. Well, it's about time that bankers and CEOs began turning loose of some of the trillions of dollars they've been hoarding. Since the crash of 2008, grassroots America has been starved of investment and job-creating enterprises. So any sign of that long-dormant capital finally beginning to move would be splendid news indeed. Except for this nagging question. Where's the money going? Hint, not to you. The big money is not being invested in job growth, grassroots enterprise, new products, or anything else that would improve your family's economic prospects. Rather, this boom is truly explosive, a job-destroying financial flimflam known grandly as the corporate merger. It amounts to nothing more than one giant corporation taking over another, or even a corporation taking over itself. The mega merger is back, exclaimed the New York Times. I'll say, already this year, $11 billion was spent to merge U.S. Air into American Airlines. Warren Buffett and a Brazilian buyout group threw $23 billion into the purchase of ketchup peddler H.J. Heinz. And Michael Dell amassed $24 billion to buy his namesake computer outfit, which he already was in charge of and owned the biggest chunk of. This is Jim Hightower saying, this buyout boom is a boon to the financial hucksters and top executives who profit from the deals, but merger mania cuts jobs, shrinks competition, raises consumer prices, concentrates wealth in fewer hands, and diverts capital from productive enterprises. What a deal for America! Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
All right, and like I said, the reality is that this is the hill we die on. This is the hill that the working class of this country is going to have to wake up to the reality that it's being taken away under the guise of, oh, we're just going to make it more whatever. Whatever words you want to use, it's going to be more shiny, safer. You know, they're going to use a lot of buzzwords. Oh, innovation. Well, you know what? We can do that as well. It's just that the moneyed interest, and you look at agency after agency, you look at things that are going on in government, it's the special interests who are lobbying to hamper every agency, all of this stuff. I mean, I look at the LCB, you know, which is, and the lottery, well, especially the lottery, where they say, well, you know, we need this company to come in and sell more tickets. Well, we could do that if it was in the best interest of all of us. Well, absolutely. But you've got huge lobbying efforts. No, can't do that. Education's the same thing. When they finally get control, and mark my words, they will. When they finally get control, things will be wonderful. There'll be no more bickering. There'll be no more fighting. It'll be all of those sci-fi novels that I remember as a kid. It'll be the Brave New World, the Logan's Run. It'll be all of those. Because there'll be no dissent. There'll be no one who can critically think enough to want a dissent. We'll be drugged all the time. I mean, we're moving towards that anyway. Yeah, it'll be a wonderful place. Anyway, the president let out his nerdiness, I guess, on Friday. Or at least that's how it's being spun. He said the fact that they don't take it means that I should somehow, you know, do a Jedi mind meld with these folks and convince them to do the right thing. Well, you know, they're elected. We have a constitutional system of government. He was talking about the sequestration, you know, why they didn't sit down and why they didn't have more of these meetings. And he's like, yeah, I can't make them. We can't do the Jedi mind meld. And some people said, hey, there's Jedi mind tricks from Star Wars, and there's Vulcan mind melds from Star Trek. Did he get it wrong, or does he know something the rest of us don't? Well, evidently Bloomberg News called up Lucasfilm and spoke with the Star Wars guru, and the Star Wars guy said, hey, you know what? There is a Jedi battle meld. Which evidently, you know, everybody who has the Force or in the Force, they link their minds towards the common good, towards the common purpose. So, was he speaking? I don't know. Maybe he read the book. Who knows? But he may know more than anyone ever suspected. Or, to be honest, that I ever cared. What I do care about is I look at the reports out. The New York Times just had a piece that said, as a percentage of national income, and this is where we need to all go with the Jedi mind meld and start going for the common good. Start thinking of something, because the Times points out as a percentage of national income, corporate profits stood at 14.2% in the third quarter of 2012. This marks the largest share at any time since 1950. While the proportion of income that went to, you know, those workers, 61.7%, the lowest point since 1966. In recent years, the shift has accelerated, you know, because of that whole financial collapse thing, the whole crisis, and, of course, the recession of 2008, 2009. Remember that? Corporate earnings, however, have risen to an annualized rate of 20.1% since the end of 2008. Disposable income, well, 1.8% over that same period. And you look at the money that's gone into the hands of these big corporations, 88%. Of the recovery, so to speak, in national growth went to profits. 1% went to workers' wages. And for you hourly workers, your wages actually fell. So your percentage of what you got out of it actually fell, which again goes back to that 121% of the recovery that Saez talks about going to the 1%. And you look at the tax rates that the very wealthy are paying has hit a 40-year low, yet the people at AP thought it was interesting and worthy to, again, continue that class war because, you know, those poor people, they don't pay taxes. You know, those 47%? The AP wrote, the poor rich, with Washington gridlocked again over whether to raise their taxes, it turns out wealthy families already are paying some of the biggest federal tax bill in decades, even as the rest of the population pays historically low rates. You know, those 47%, and they go into it, you know, those people at the bottom, you know, those people who make minimum wage, they actually have a negative tax rate because the conservative Milton Friedman thought it would be a good idea to bring them in to be consumers so we can get money from him. Just a thought. And if you really think about what they did, which is masterful, they took money from the middle class to give to poor people so you could keep them divided and fighting at each other so that the poor people could be consumers and keep the middle class employed. So as the middle class is running on the treadmill because they're trying to keep ahead, they're trying to pay their bills, they're trying to keep food on the table, they look at that low-wage worker screwing us because we're giving them money. Not thinking that really the truth of the matter is the very top, they're the folks who are, well, better off than they've been in decades. Even though this article loves to say, you know, the people at the very top, they're paying the highest tax rate since 1979. You know, because income, payroll, corporate, and estate taxes, they're paying way up there. Now, that doesn't include the dividend and capital gains part. No, let's not be distracted by having facts in there. The reality is, while their bill may be higher, it's because the distribution of wealth is way out of whack. And I love this take that somehow we're abusing the poor rich. You know, they have hurt feelings. My uncle was a perfect example of this, especially during the election, saying, you know, I do a lot of charity work, and you know what, I'm not going to do it anymore. And I'm going, that's why I don't want you doing charity work. Interestingly enough, the IRS keeps track of the tax returns of the 400 highest paid filers each year. These are people who, the big money folks, average around $202 million for the tax year of 2009. That's the last year we have official data. Their federal tax their income rate, 19.9%. Now you think about someone like you or me making about $46,000 a year, that middle 20%, almost 14% we pay in income. In federal income tax. That has gone down a bit over the past three decades because it was 16%. But, you know, I'm sorry, I'm kind of confused at why the poor rich who $202 million, think about comparing that $202 million in a year to the guy making 46 grand, being only a couple of percent off. Fact of the matter is after tax incomes, on the average, for the top 1%, have more than doubled from 1979 to 2009, increasing by 155%. This is CBO numbers, not mine. Didn't make them up. Average income is for those folks in the middle, you know, that middle 20%, increased by 32%, and people at the bottom saw theirs go up by 45%. So you're talking about a massive redistribution of wealth. So you look at this increase in inequality, yeah, that's why they have so much and why it's kind of wrong. I mean, why is it that the work that you do and the work that I do and the work that people who create the wealth, not sharing in it, but yet we have to pay homage to the chair? And a little bit later on, I want to talk about John Boehner's appearance on Sunday talking about, you know, we need to, again, more tax cuts for the very wealthy with this whole sequester thing. And it just blows my mind. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
You might have heard the saying, like a moth to a flame, to describe a fatal attraction. But why are moths attracted to flame?
The fact is, scientists think moths aren't so much attracted to the light of a flame or other bright light as they are disoriented by it. Here's how it works. Like many flying insects, moths are able to find their way partly by using light as a compass.
When the source of light is the sun or moon, that light source is very distant, and the incoming light rays that strike an insect arrive just about parallel to each other. So moths, and many other flying insects, have evolved to expect to receive light at a fixed part of their eye. As long as the moth flies more or less in a straight line, this visual pattern remains unchanged.
Now consider what happens when the light source is a nearby street light. Then the angle at which the light strikes the moth's eye quickly changes. If the moth holds to a straight line course, the moth tries to do what it's evolved to do under the light of the sun or moon, that is, maintain a constant angle to the source.
And as it does so, it spirals in toward the light, so the moth seems attracted to the light, so much so that it might end up drawn into a flame. More frequently asked science questions at earthsky.org. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So there's a big educational technology conference this week in Texas, I believe Austin, Texas, where they're, you know, the big corporations are going to be showing off their latest gadgets, their latest innovations in education. Yes, their software. Yes, their testing, all their tests. Yes, they're going to have the bells, the whistles. And one of the things they're going to have is a new student database. Yes, an electronic, a centralized database. Where, you know what, we're going to be able to have all of the students' records from across the country in the same place. And, you know, as I thought through this, as I was reading the article, and because understand the money's coming from the usual suspects, Murdoch's Amplify Education, you know, Rupert Murdoch, the News Corp guy, his Amplify Education, a division of News Corp. Doesn't that scare you? I mean, really stop and think about, having read the book 1984, doesn't it really scare the hell out of you that a propaganda arm, a propaganda network like fake news, is getting into the education business, that they've got an education division? Kind of scares me. The Gates Foundation also, you know, they're going to have some, they've put some big money into it as well, you know, because, I don't know why, man. I mean, you look at the money in this, and it just blows my mind. They have their InBloom Incorporated, which is a non-profit organization, but still, I look at it as a control magnet. News Corp built the infrastructure for this database with the funding from the Gates Foundation, and 7 states right now have signed into it: Colorado, Delaware, Georgia, Illinois, Kentucky, North Carolina, and Massachusetts. They have committed to enter data from different school districts. The article points out that Louisiana and New York will be entering nearly all of student records statewide. So you're going to have this, and my thought was, is what would people do if the government, if Obama said, we're going to collect all of your children's names, put them in a centralized database with their name, age, social security number, stuff like that, what would they do? And what would they do with the fact that, according to the Department of Education, schools don't even have to notify parents for consent. And under the guise of, well, they're sharing student records with school officials who have a legitimate educational interest. What is school official? And explain to me what legitimate educational interest in a centralized database is. Or am I missing something? And I started, as I read it, I'm thinking back, okay, we're going to have this eventually national data database, because now the article says it's free for right now. So, you know, hey, Pennsylvania, you can jump right on this bandwagon because it's free till 2015, at which point the billionaires will have you hooked on it, and then good luck getting out of it. Think about that. Reminds me of the ATM cards. Remember? They got you hooked on it. Now you can't live without the damn thing. They charge you $3 or $4 every time you use it. But I was thinking about when my oldest daughter was born. And I've told this story before because I think it's important. Because we had done the cord blood. One of the things, I don't know what 20 years of technology and healthcare is going to bring. But I like to stay up on cutting edge technology stuff to a degree. And it seemed reasonable to spend, I think it was like $1,400, $1,500 to collect the cord blood and store it for 20 years. Because at the time they were saying we could cure childhood leukemia with these virgin stem cells. I mean, it's what you were born, it's what you came to this world, with without having been damaged by years of whatever. And so it seemed reasonable, about $1,500, willing to do it. Well, evidently someone must have gotten the records or got wind of it. And before I knew it, there was a guy selling me this idea to chip my daughter. He said, well, you know, we could, just a little rice-sized kernel under the fatty part of her upper arm, and you'll be able to find wherever she's at. We'll be able to locate her. It's an RFID chip, you know, little satellite will track her right down. And I was dead set against it, because my first question is, well, what if I don't want her found? What if she doesn't want to be found? What if I don't want you to find her? What if I don't want the government to fight? What, are you kidding me? And it would turn into this weird conversation. So now I'm thinking about, let's say, you know, we start mandating that children get chipped and they're part of this centralized corporate registry. Not even in the, with the control of what happens by government, by us, but by private corporations. Think of the business opportunities there. You know, cause you see some of those sci-fi movies where you're walking down the mall and all of a sudden everything that, it's kind of like the Google ads. I look for something and before I know it, the websites I'm looking at have all of the things that I've been looking at saying, here, don't you like this? Wouldn't you like to have this? That's how you look at it. Here's another one. I mean, just from a business perspective, this is an amazing advertisement opportunity, not to mention control, not to mention tracking, not to mention, you know, all of the things that go with. But I think back to the book 1984, which is kind of the, you know, the playbook, if you will. How close are we to that? I mean, how close are we to the technology and the control and the, and it, it's not government doing it. It's private interests with the help of government. That's what scares me. And when the right way, you know, look, I have as much distrust of government as anyone, especially conservative government. The reason that I am a pro-government person is that because I do believe it's us. It's we the people. It's our government. It's not the evil government. It's our government. We voted for the government that we have. We put these people into positions of power collectively. We did this. We can undo it. But you look at these corporations who are very secretive, they don't, and now they're claiming to have rights, the same rights that you and me and our children have. Doesn't that give you pause? Doesn't it give you a cause to stop for a second and say, wait a second. Do I want all of my kids' records being centralized in a corporate database held by someone like Murdoch's News Corp? Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get our podcast. Of course, Stitcher, if you've got a smartphone, the ability to take the program on the go. And like I said, over the weekend when we were at the Keystone Progressive Summit, a lot of folks I got to meet who did just that. Quick break, back with Hour 2.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Politicians spent most of the weekend trying to shift blame for who was responsible for a series of drastic cuts that went into effect on Friday, known as the sequester. President Barack Obama was required to sign the $85 billion in cuts, and as he did, he called them dumb and arbitrary. The impact of the cuts will likely be felt for months and could be inflamed as Congress gears up for a budget debate this month. The president said he isn't interested in making deals month by month, a strategy that has been aggressively employed by the Republican House over the last 4 years, but is instead seeking a long-term but balanced approach. The intensity of the sequester fallout will depend on where one lives. Here's a roundup of what different regions are projecting. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Sunday that his state is already feeling the impact of the sequester, and a great deal of that is the psychological fallout from political brinkmanship. The direct impact in New York will include a loss of $42.7 million for primary and secondary education. That could see 590 teachers and aides out of work. Nearly 4,300 children will be impacted by necessary cuts to Head Start programs. Seniors in the state will lose out in nearly $1.5 million in meals. Pennsylvania is losing $37.5 million in federal funding to a number of housing programs. Loss of funding to one Pennsylvania program, the tenant-based rental assistance program, will directly affect more than 4,000 families. In Wisconsin, $10.1 million in federal funding is being lost in the state's Education for Children with Disabilities program. That state's university system will likely lose $35 million in research funding. California will see $62.9 million slashed from special education programs. 10,000 college work-study programs will be lost. The unemployed will also be hit with a setback in the quest for gainful employment, as $3 million in unemployment support will be eliminated.
The AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today released a joint statement on shared principles concerning immigration reform. Those principles include that Americans should have first crack at available jobs, but that laws permit businesses to hire foreign workers without going through a cumbersome and inefficient process to do it when needed. The Labor Federation and the Chamber say the challenge is to create a mechanism that responds to the needs of business while also fully protecting the wages and working conditions of U.S. and immigrant workers. The two organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but their joint statement says the nation needs to fix the immigration system in part by establishing a professional bureau in a federal executive agency with political independence to inform Congress and the public about immigration issues.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So John Boehner was on Meet the Depressed over the weekend with David Gregory. And it was one of those moments where you go, here is a guy who's really pitching the right-wing line and just reiterating the talking point over and over. And there's part of me that thinks he actually believes what it is he was saying. Now, they're talking about, you know, this idea that, you know, we can't cut our way to prosperity. We can't, and I agree with Boehner when he says, you can't do it. We cannot cut enough to balance the budget. We cannot cut enough to have prosperity. And we're seeing a very live experiment going on right before our eyes. You look at what's going on in Europe. This is what happens when you pursue austerity. It's just common sense. The more you pull out of the economy, the more revenue, the more resource, the more spending, the more it slows. The more it slows, the layoffs start to come, people start pulling back, and it's a self-perpetuating thing. You continue to spiral downward. Consumer confidence goes down, consumer spending goes down, and we end up in the tank. Now, the right would have you believe, oh, we can do all these things. We can cut, and take food out of the mouths of children and all these things, and the economy will it'll be wonderful. And we can continue to cut spending, not spending it on education or infrastructure or anything else. We can continue to cut and give more to the well-to-do, and things will be wonderful. So Boehner was on Meet the Press, and, well, this is what he had to say.
But we can't cut our way to prosperity. We also have to have real economic growth. American families' wages aren't growing. They're being squeezed. And as a result, we've got to find a way through our tax code to promote more economic growth in our country. We can do this by closing loopholes, bringing the rates down for all Americans, making the tax code fairer. It will promote more economic growth.
It'll promote more economic growth. And Gregory goes in, well, you know, there's no ironclad evidence in that. You'll hear that in the next clip. But I agree with him. Wages are being squeezed by policies that he promotes. There's nothing that the Republicans are pushing that will make wages go up. It's just not happening. And he throws this idea out through our tax code, we need to promote more economic growth, which he's saying we need more handouts, more tax breaks for the well-to-do so that they can do what they've done already, which is not create jobs. And the frame You know, 5 years ago is the same frame it is now. You can give a rich guy a tax cut, and he's going to take a vacation. He's not going to create a job. You give him demand. You put money in consumers' pockets, and they go to his shop or his store or his service or whatever, and he will create jobs to meet that. It's a fundamental difference between what the right is peddling and what reality is. This idea that we can continue to give more to the well-to-do and that somehow that's going to promote economic growth is a fallacy at best and a bold-faced fabrication and just a bold-faced lie. So Gregory goes into this thing. He says, you know, but there's no ironclad evidence. And I love the Boehner response.
Economic growth. Ironclad evidence that lowering marginal tax rates is going to lead to economic growth.
Oh, yes, there is. There's
Bill
mountains.
Clinton raised taxes. President Reagan raised taxes.
There's mountains of evidence that if we bring tax rates down, that we will help spur economic growth in our country.
Yep, and if we just bring those down. Just bring them down. It's going to spur economic growth. And again, it's another one of those moments of I believe. I've been told this so often. There's mountains of evidence, which there's not. I guess if you buy into the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation, you know, all of those right-wing think tanks who have their one guy write something and 10 people write around it. And they use each other as expert sources so that they can create their own alternative reality. Not that it's actually true, but that it's a different reality. And as Gregory points out, Clinton raised taxes, Reagan raised taxes, what, 11 times during his presidency? You never hear that. Never hear that. But you do hear a lot of what Boehner said next.
That hasn't been tried before?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan, 1981.
Right. He also raised taxes.
And it worked very well.
But he raised taxes as well, and it didn't hurt the economy, did it?
Listen, he lowered taxes twice, both in 1981 and again out of the 1986 tax reform. When they lowered rates for all Americans, we had this boom in economic growth. Why? Because we got rid of a lot of the silly deductions, brought the rates down, and it helped promote more economic growth in our country.
Yeah, oh, more economic. Does anybody remember the Bush recession? Does anybody remember the beginning? See, because I lived through the Reagan years. They aren't as rosy as Boehner will have us or attempt to have us believe. I remember 1981. I remember the only two times in my life I've ever been laid off from a job, and there was a Bush in the White House both times. I remember that it wasn't a boom time. 1981. Let's take a look at the 81 tax cut that he talks about. Understand, in 1981, the top marginal rate was still 70%. 1980, it was 70%. He brought it down to 50%. So you had a pretty big infusion, one of the biggest in history. So there was a lot of money that went somewhere quickly. And there was a little blip on the screen. It did, for a very short period of time, increase economic activity. But it also did is it began that massive expansion of inequality. And in conjunction with this big, huge tax cut came the cut in interest rates. Because if you remember going back to Volcker, back during the Carter years, and the whole stagflation and all that, where interest rates were somewhere in the 20% range. You know, I had an uncle who bought a house with a 16% mortgage and was okay with it because he was making a decent living at the time, could pay it. And, of course, you got to write that off, and it all came out as a wash. So you go and you look, you know, okay, well, that was a massive change in interest rates, a massive influx of investment. And it did, for a very short period of time, it did increase activity. But it wasn't enough. So they thought, oh, well, if we did it this much from 70 down to 50, we cut those interest rates more almost in half, it'll be that much greater. So in comes the Tax Reform Bill of 86, which, now remember what Boehner said. He said, got rid of a lot of those silly deductions, you know, like interest on car payments, interest you pay car loans, you know, on any bank interest. You know, people like you and me who took those loans out, did away with that. And let's not forget taxing unemployment for the first time in history. You know, those silly things. lowered that top marginal rate down again from 50 all the way down to 28%. Closed some loopholes and did close a lot of corporate loopholes. But the very next day, started giving them back again. So for a very short period of time, there was a little bit of economic boom. There was some recovery. There was something there. But not mountains of growth, not mountains of research, not mountains of evidence. We can't duplicate what they did back then because we don't have a 70% top marginal tax rate to bring down. We don't even have a 50% top marginal rate to bring down. It's 39%. And you look at Bruce Bartlett, who was Reagan's senior economic policy advisor. And he said, look, the reality is we use the Fed to bring down those high interest rates. We were fighting inflation. And it worked. It was designed to bring down inflation, which is why you hear the Republicans saying we need to use the Fed to, as a sole purpose is to fight inflation. Because what the wealthy don't want is they don't want hyper, they don't want inflation because it eats away at their wealth. Now, you get to pay your bills off quicker, especially if you've got fixed loans and you're in debt. You're going to pay some of that off because wages are going to have to rise and a whole bunch of things to go along with it. Now, it's negative. A lot of it's negative. But it's going to hurt the very, very well to do. And they know that, which is why they're pushing against it. But also Bartlett says that, you know, this idea that the tax reform bill of 86 spurred economic growth or affected the unemployment rate is just wrong. And he's saying that wasn't it. There's no evidence, he said, that it had anything to do with economic growth or employment rates. But I go back to, you know, what caused George H.W. Bush to lose re-election to Bill Clinton? And only one thing. And it was read my lips. Because he saw, and I give him credit for this. This is one of the things I absolutely give him credit for. He saw the growing inequality. He saw the massive debts, the massive accumulation of debt. And he said, I've got to do something. And I give him credit for going back and saying, look, we've for the good of the country, this is something we've got to do. So when I look at this, I simply say, you know, we've got things that we've got to do right now. And this is one of them. And we hear the same voices, don't we? We're hearing the same voices saying, you know what? We need that same kind of policy again. Because it works so well. You know what it did? It works so well at creating more inequality in our country. That's what it worked at. When we come back, I want to talk about what happened in Switzerland as the Swiss voters decided, you know what, maybe we should have, people who, stockholders, have some say on what the executive gets paid. Quick break, right back, stick around.
All right, just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
The word of the day is boom. Yes, boom times are upon us again. The stars came into alignment, marveled one financial manager. Corporate confidence returns, applauded a recent headline. We're finally dusting off the cobwebs, rejoiced a business analyst, pointing out that banks are willing to take risks. Well, it's about time that bankers and CEOs began turning loose of some of the trillions of dollars they've been hoarding. Since the crash of 2008, grassroots America has been starved of investment and job-creating enterprises. So any sign of that long-dormant capital finally beginning to move would be splendid news indeed. Except for this nagging question. Where's the money going? Hint, not to you. The big money is not being invested in job growth, grassroots enterprise, new products, or anything else that would improve your family's economic prospects. Rather, this boom is truly explosive, a job-destroying financial flimflam known grandly as the corporate merger. It amounts to nothing more than one giant corporation taking over another, or even a corporation taking over itself. The mega merger is back, exclaimed the New York Times. I'll say, already this year, $11 billion was spent to merge U.S. Air into American Airlines. Warren Buffett and a Brazilian buyout group threw $23 billion into the purchase of ketchup peddler H.J. Heinz. And Michael Dell amassed $24 billion to buy his namesake computer outfit, which he already was in charge of and owned the biggest chunk of. This is Jim Hightower saying, this buyout boom is a boon to the financial hucksters and top executives who profit from the deals, but merger mania cuts jobs, shrinks competition, raises consumer prices, concentrates wealth in fewer hands, and diverts capital from productive enterprises. What a deal for America! Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org. The word of the day is
fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. A lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
Yes, fudge the numbers. Fudge the numbers.
Diplomacy to work, lies must be credible. Yeah, I mean, it's not... Fudge the number sounds like something you do in the corporate boardrooms. And I just look at the Swiss vote where they have approved the measure that says, you know what, shareholders should have a right to hold a binding vote on compensation for the executives and their directors. There should be greater transparency of what these corporations are doing. They should know how much money is being loaned out to these executives. And I like the fact that one of the things I liked, the fine up to 6 years of salary and 3 years in prison. What I would say, 6 years fine, and be forced to work for the company for those 6 years free. There's a thought. Anyway, it is what it is. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I've got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Fine, Rick. How about yourself?
Oh, I cannot complain.
Hey, that deal in Switzerland, that was a big deal.
It is a big deal.
That was front page of the Financial Times. Are you hearing that? I'm not hearing that anywhere in the mainstream media.
No.
And that has the corporate boardrooms around the world scared you know what.
Oh, I don't know. Not in this country, because I think they've got our political system pretty much bought up.
Well,
I mean, look at Dodd-Frank. Look at the meager restrictions that would have been put in place there, and still nothing.
Well, you just got to look at who's on the board of the regulators who were supposed to make that happen. You know, they left a lot of dotting the I's and crossing the T's to the regulators who were captive, like Mark Wetjen over at the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, who's supposed to be a Democrat, in quotes, one of Harry Reid's staffers. And here he is going along with the Republicans, watering it down.
At the end of the day, Andy, there are some things that are nonpartisan. It just is what it is, and whether you're a Republican or a corporate Democrat, they're all feeding from the same trough.
But at least this Swiss deal in Europe, and for those companies there, like UBS and Novartis, who just tried to give their CEO something like 78 million or
77
something like that, 77 in compensation. They had to take that back. And this guy, what is it, Thomas Minder, who's been working on this for years, 68% of the vote on this plebiscite. I mean, that's wonderful.
It is, and I believe if it were to be put to a vote here, we would get the same 68%. It's just that our political system has been that badly corrupted by the moneyed interest. And it's to me, it's the moneyed interest. And it's not, you know, your local CEO who runs the little corner store or bank or whatever. It's these big fat cats.
Right, you're using exactly the same word as Mr. Minder. You see, too, where he actually tried to break into it, not break in, but took the podium of a UBS shareholder meeting, and he had a got roughed up by the guards of this Marcel Ospel, I think his name is, the previous chairman of UBS.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy is something else. He's really going to bat, and he just calls the whole corporate board system, even in Europe, you know, just totally corrupt.
Well, it's what we need to be doing here, and we need to be doing more of. Now, there are some, but we need it on a much grander scale. I truly believe, you know, you look at – I look at Jack Lew, you know, our new Treasury guy. He was given a goodbye, as they called it here in the article, of $1 million. I call it a bribe, but you know, it is what it is. I'm sorry, not a bribe. It was for new curtains in the new office. But still, I mean, you're talking a going away president that you and I never get when we get thrown out of a job.
You know, his bonus too at Citigroup was somehow actually tied to him getting a high level government job. That was actually a stipulation in his Citigroup bonus, you know, that he would go back into government and be in a position that he could actually, you know,
not surprising.
Screw around with legislation that's going to be positive to the financial industry.
Again, nothing surprising.
Jesus, it's so corrupt.
That's why we've got to be involved in, which is, like I keep saying, we voted these people in. We should vote them out.
Right. Well, we have a referendum state here. You know, that thing on having a shareholder vote on boards of directors might be something possible to do at a state level.
Yeah.
Got
to start somewhere. And California might as well be the place to start it. So get to work.
Exactly. You're taking the words right out from me.
Yeah, well, yeah, get to work. This is how change is affected, by people like you, by people starting with their neighbor and their communities and you know, taking it off.
Right, but anyway, that Swiss deal was a good shot across the bow, man.
There you go.
Across the bow. All right, take care.
Appreciate
show,
it,
man.
Thanks so much, Andy. And, you know, you look at this, and you look at the handouts that these corporate CEOs have been getting for years, and one of my favorite to talk about, it's always been Jack Welch, the guy from GE. And there are reasons I love divorces. And I know it's a horrible thing to say, but there are. I mean, if you go and you looked at back in 2002, there was a report about Welch, the retirement package he got as it was laid out in the divorce settlement. And you look at some of the things that to this day, General Electric is still paying this guy who retired back in 2002. He gets a luxury apartment there at the Trump International Hotel and Towers, Central Park West. Fresh flowers, wine, laundry, and dry cleaning. A cook, a wait staff, housekeeper, and everything that you can imagine, down to the toiletries, toilet paper included. Magazines, newspaper subscriptions, postage, you name it, he's getting it. They pick up the bill to his going out to exclusive restaurants and the one located in his building. You know, opera tickets, baseball, football, basketball tickets, you name it, the French Open, Wimbledon. You name it, he's got it. VIP stuff to the Olympics, unlimited use of their 737, you know, huge, huge money. A limo, a driver, bodyguards, you know, you name it, he's getting it. And you go, well, wait a second, what about the millions of jobs that this guy's responsible for outsourcing? What about all this? And you go, the amount of money that these people get, obscene. He's a guy who cut... Well, and I guess it doesn't matter when you look at the corporate world. You look at the big oil executives when Lee Raymond left ExxonMobil with over a $320 million payout. You look at Bill McGuire, the guy from United Healthcare, almost $300 million payout. Home Depot when Nardelli got fired, $223 million. And you go, but you know, these are folks that Wait, hold on. It's outrageous. The healthcare executives are just through the roof. Hundreds of thousands of dollars go to these people. And for what? I look at the guy from Target who worked there, what, about 14 years, walked away with $165 million? A company built on the backs of lower-waged workers, and this guy's going to walk away with that kind of a, thank you very much? And a bank I've never even heard of, North Fork Bank. Guy was there for less than 20 years, and well, I guess less than like 28 years, $215,000. Nice. Where do we get that? Where do working class people get that? Well, the truth of the matter is you don't, because you don't have a contract. And they don't want you to have a contract. And you could go down the whole list, and you know there's some really just outrageous examples, but Welch being the top of it. Well over $400,000 in payout, not to mention Fresh Flowers for Life. I mean, what's that? Think about that for a second. I guess it's good for the economy. People keep being employed. But it's outrageous. The amount of money that we heap upon these well-to-do. And I look at the story in Sweden, to me, is a step in that right direction. We should have workers on those corporate boards. They should be transparent. But you know they're not. What's it going to take? What's it going to take for us to be frustrated enough to say enough is enough already? And then we have to hear stories about, oh, the poor wealthy. Oh, they're so poor. They're being beat up on. Do you not get that we have a massive gulf between that top 1% and the rest of society? I mean, even in the top 10%, there's a gulf. And I chuckled as my uncle talked about in his neighborhood. He lives in a very gated community of very well-to-do people. He's at the bottom of that 0.1%. And even in that little microcosm, in that little community, he's not in the upper echelon. I mean, they've divided themselves. They keep themselves out, which is hysterical to me. So I guess what's it going to take for us to say, you know what, we need to be tearing down these walls. We need to have that great compression again, where we all live in the same neighborhood, where his kids go to basically the same school that your kids and my kids go to. And not because I want to pull them down, because I don't. I want to raise everyone up. And you saw investments in school during the times when the wealth class's kids and that upper tier where their kids went to the same school. You saw a mentality of we need to invest in schools. We need to invest in their future and the outcomes. Now what you're seeing is, well, the wealth is saying privatize, privatize, privatize. So that one, we can make money off of it, especially off those poor kids who aren't going to do anything anyway. And two, have control. Total control of the system and control of the message. Scary stuff and frustrating on so many levels. But Free Flowers for Life, that's just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing. Anyway, got to take a quick break. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to...
America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555.
or visit pseccu.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
You might have heard the saying, like a moth to a flame, to describe a fatal attraction. But why are moths attracted to flame?
The fact is, scientists think moths aren't so much attracted to the light of a flame or other bright light as they are disoriented by it. Here's how it works. Like many flying insects, moths are able to find their way partly by using light as a compass.
When the source of light is the sun or moon, that light source is very distant, and the incoming light rays that strike an insect arrive just about parallel to each other. So moths, and many other flying insects, have evolved to expect to receive light at a fixed part of their eye. As long as the moth flies more or less in a straight line, this visual pattern remains unchanged.
Now, consider what happens when the light source is a nearby street light. Then the angle at which the light strikes the moth's eye quickly changes if the moth holds to a straight line course. The moth tries to do what it's evolved to do under the light of the sun or moon, that is, maintain a constant angle to the source.
And as it does so, it spirals in toward the light, so the moth seems attracted to the light, so much so that it might end up drawn into a flame. More frequently asked science questions at EarthSky.org. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. We're at EarthSky.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
So over the weekend, the folks at Keystone Progress held their Pennsylvania Progressive Summit. There were a lot of really good panels and a lot of good workshops to attend. And a couple of them that I wanted to go to, I wish, you know, there was more time that you could go to most of them, or at least had the opportunity to view them somehow. Maybe next year they'll work on that, putting them online that were where if you couldn't be there, you'd be able to still get the information. And one of them was on gun safety and all of the misinformation, all of the heated rhetoric, you know, how do you decipher through what's true, what's not, the confusing policy, all the things around it. How do you do that? It's one of the ones that I'd like to have seen, which is why I've asked Shira Goodman, executive director of Ceasefire PA, who had done a panel there at the summit about this, to come talk to us. Shira, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, it's one of these things where there's a lot of heated rhetoric and what I don't know most of the time what's true. I get a lot of emails from my NRA friends. Obama's taking guns. Yet I can find no policy. I can find no law, no legislation. It's just a blind faith or just, well, a lie.
Well, I think that, right, there's this fear that any changes in the gun laws will lead to that ultimate, you know, slippery slope of they're taking guns. And really that's not what's on the table anywhere. What's being discussed are expanding background checks, harsher penalties for trafficking of guns and gun crimes. They're talking about bans on certain kinds of weapons, but almost every proposed law that I've seen would grandfather in existing possession of those weapons. So there is, you know, that scare tactic from the gun lobby that any change in the law will ultimately lead to lists of gun owners and confiscation, but that's not real. It's not based in reality. It's not what anybody that I know or work with is talking about.
Yeah, the whole confiscating guns, I've not heard anyone say, but, you know, I thought it was already decided that there were things that we couldn't have. Like, I can't have a stealth bomber or a howitzer, or I can't have a nuclear weapon or any of that stuff, can I?
No, I certainly hope not. You can't have a fully automatic weapon, and that's for years and years. But we're talking, and then, you know, but the 1994 ban on certain kinds of assault semi-automatic weapons expired. But that also had a grandfathering provision, so all the weapons that were available before 94 were, you know, weren't taken away, and then once that expired in 2004, people were free to buy them again. So those, I mean, and that's a challenge in if some kind of ban is implemented. What is, you know, is, can it be as effective with all those guns still out there? But I think that's the kind of thing that gets that rhetoric going and that kind of blocks compromise, because the gun lobby has just scared people into believing that that's what's going to happen. And people who want change and who want common sense regulations really have to try and find common ground and be very clear that nobody's talking about undoing the Second Amendment or taking away guns. We're trying to keep illegal guns off the street and out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them.
Yeah, I'm with you. But how much of it do you think is people's misinterpretation of the Second Amendment? Because I have friends who truly believe that they should be allowed to have any munition that they want, that they should have the right to bear the howitzer or whatever, that's what that gives them, that right.
Well, I think what happens is people look at those, a small part of the Second Amendment, or, you know, the part of the Pennsylvania Constitution, and they look at those last words, you know, and the Second Amendment shall not be infringed, and in Pennsylvania's Constitution shall not be questioned, and they forget in the middle. You know, the Pennsylvania's Constitution talks specifically about in defense of self or state, and the Supreme Court of the United States has interpreted the Second Amendment to say, yes, you have a personal right to bear arms, but like our other constitutional freedoms, it's subject to reasonable restriction, and people don't like that part about the reasonable restriction. I don't think it's really about what does the Second Amendment mean anymore. The United States Supreme Court has said there's this personal right to bear arms. The question is what kind of reasonable restrictions are there? We know you can have background checks. Like you said, for a long time there have been certain weapons that you just can't possess as a civilian. And we have to have a real conversation about that. And there's nothing in the Second Amendment or the Pennsylvania Constitution that should preclude that.
So what is reasonable? I mean, that's an interesting word, one open to considerable interpretation. What do you view as reasonable?
Well, I view expansion for a background check for every gun sale as reasonable. And I don't mean from a father passing on to his son, but I mean beyond that. If I'm going to sell you a rifle, we should have to go to the store just like if I were going to sell you a handgun.
Or a car.
And get a background check. If I lose my gun or I find that it's been stolen from my wherever I keep it, I should have to report that to the police. Right now in Pennsylvania, we don't have a state law requiring that. Some towns and municipalities have tried to do it on their own, but they've been challenged, and there's questions about whether towns and cities can do it on their own because of the state preemption law. Things like making sure other states get their mental health records into the national database, like Pennsylvania just did a few weeks ago. Those are all kinds of things that really do not put additional burdens on law-abiding gun owners, and they do make it harder and cut the flow and the avenues that people who are intent on doing harm, who shouldn't be having guns, it makes it harder for them to get them, and I think that's what we want to do.
And looking at the Newtown shooting, what do you say to those who say it wouldn't have stopped that from happening? Because, you know, we want to stop these horrible tragedies from happening. But what do you say to those who, you know, even this stuff wouldn't have stopped someone who's unstable or really determined to do some of this stuff?
Well, we don't know exactly what happened, if he stole the gun from his mother, if she never reported it missing, if she gave him access. So there was some kind of breakdown there. Either she wasn't securing her guns, she knew her son certainly was suffering under some kind of mental disabilities and emotional challenges and didn't do enough to secure her guns or get them out of the house. And, you know, we know that doctors and psychologists lots of times will tell parents, if their child is at risk, that they should get guns out of the house. She didn't do that. So that is something that would be different, putting that kind of requirement on gun owners. But we also know that, yes, somebody intent on doing real harm does find a way. But if that person had a limit on the size of the magazine clips, he might have been able to not, if he had to reload more quickly, he might not have been able to do as much damage and harm as he did. Right. I mean, when they talk about the bodies of those children, they had multiple bullet holes. And, you know, he only shot for a couple minutes. So some of these things, Would it have totally prevented everything? No, but it could have minimized damage. And the truth is, just because we can't solve every problem doesn't mean we shouldn't try to solve some of them.
That's an excellent point. Because what I was going to bring up is, you know, I have someone who tells me, well, you know, there's a mother in Atlanta who, you know, if she would have needed extra bullets to shoot the intruder, then what would you have said? And, you know, there are valid arguments on all sides of this, but at some point, there's got to be some rational thought in here.
Right. We also know, you know, I heard that. I was in Washington when that woman testified about the women who should be home and be able to have as many bullets as they need. You know, statistics show that women are much more likely, if there's a gun in the home, to be killed by a partner
right.
or somebody else than to use it in defensively to protect their homes. Now, I'm not saying that women who want to have guns for safety and who are law-abiding citizens shouldn't have them and be well-trained in how to use them and secure them, but I am saying that the facts show that guns in the home do create danger for people in the home, especially for women.
Yeah, I think back to the woman from the Reading area who was in the national spotlight for a couple of minutes because she carried a sidearm to her 6-year-old soccer game, and it caught national attention. She was actually ended up being killed by her, I guess it was her husband or live-in boyfriend or whatever it was, while her gun was hanging on the chair.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, so we know that... you know, even people who are trained and who are used to it can be overtaken or can have their own guns used against them or might not be able to have access to their gun. So we know that more guns and arming everybody is not the solution. And I was on a show with a police chief a few weeks ago, and he said, a teacher said to him, you know, do you think I should get a gun? And he said, are you prepared to kill somebody? And she said, no. And he said, then you shouldn't have a gun.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a difference, and then I think the conversation has to lead to, there's a difference between the urban mentality and the rural mentality. And I look at myself. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland where if someone had a gun, there was no good coming of that. There was somebody going to get shot, somebody going to get killed. And I move into a more urban area where, you know, guns are part of the culture, where, you know, you went out and you shot tin cans, you went hunting with dad on the weekends or whatever. So there are different views of guns and different uses for them. And is that something that could be melded into policy as well?
I think that it should be. I mean, I think that when people talk about wanting to have access to certain kinds of weapons for shooting, for target shooting, for going to the range, I think that if we work together, we could find solutions to have those available to those people who are sportsmen and want them, but have them secured some way. But that's not even on the table because we can't get to the table together. But I think we should be able to take into account our cultural differences, you know, statistical problems in our cities and towns versus, you know, our rural areas, you know, places where hunting and people bring, you know, there are places, very rural areas during hunting season where kids drive with their guns to school. I mean, which seems crazy. You know, I live in suburban Philadelphia, but that could never happen here. But I think that if we were really having honest policy dialogue and debate, we could, you know, take all that into account. But it's very hard to get everybody to the table to do that.
Yeah, because I've seen people shot, and it's not pretty.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality in this is there are two very different world views on it. And I guess I'm fortunate that I've lived in both worlds. And I think if we were able to see from the other point of view where, you know, one and the other, I think you would then be able to maybe reach some consensus and some common ground on this.
I think you're right. And I think that, it's on both sides that we should be able to discuss what the needs are in our different areas. And that's part of the reason that some of the towns and cities that have passed laws that apply only to their cities are so frustrated when the courts rule that they're preempted by state law, because maybe one size doesn't fit all in Pennsylvania. We have a very, you know, geographically diverse state. Our cities and towns are very different. We have a, you know, different kinds of histories. And maybe they should have those. Local areas should have more autonomy to make policies that fit their people and the needs of their community.
Yeah, and the people who tell us that they believe in local government and local control are the ones who are trying to use the larger entity to force down on everyone else.
Right. Well, you know, nobody ever said you have to be consistent in what you think, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's what works at the moment. But part of the problem is just not being able to get people to talk to each other. And I think we need to call on our leaders to do it. You know, it's very easy for them to go up there and say, you know what, nothing's going to happen, and I'm not going to take the tough votes, or I'm not going to force my people to take the tough votes. Well, I didn't elect my representatives and senators to not take tough votes. You know, if I wanted them to just go to Harrisburg and D.C. and do nothing, I would have voted for somebody else. I mean, I want them to go and take tough votes and do the work that we sent them there to do.
Yeah, see, I did vote for somebody else, so I can't make that argument.
Okay.
Anyway, so are you seeing anything being done? I understand today there was a gun trafficking bill in the Senate that was moved forward. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's important because I don't think that just having new regulations is the answer. We do need to have tough criminal laws and penalties so that people know if they have illegal guns, if they traffic in illegal guns, that they're going to face real consequences, and that give our police and prosecutors tools to get the big fish if they need to. And so I think that those are really important. And the fact that we don't actually have a federal straw purchaser bill on the books or a trafficker bill, that, and this will do that and give a mandatory minimum, I think that's important. And I think these are the kinds of things that if we can package with an upgraded regulatory system, will really help. We need strong criminal penalties, and we need judges who are going to give tough sentences to people who violate gun laws.
Yeah, I'm with you. So what do we do? I mean, what's the call to action?
I think the call to action is that people need to make their voices heard. They need to call and email and write their representatives, both in D.C. and Harrisburg, and let them know they care about this, that it's not going to be okay to let time go and nothing happen, that we want to see some reasonable solutions like these trafficking bills, like expanding background checks, and that we expect them to come and have hearings and let us be heard. But that's the key thing, I mean, because we know that people on the other side have been single-issue voters, have been really good at getting their message out, and we need to do that too, because our voices have been kind of diffuse on lots of different issues, and that's important because we care about lots of different things. But if you care about this issue, you need to tell them, because it's very easy. You know, they want to know that people from their constituency who can vote for them, they want to know what they care about. So if you care about it, you got to tell the people that represent you whether or not you voted for them, because they still work for you.
Yeah, they need that political cover, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I understand that your website, ceasefirepa.org, you've got a pledge you want folks to take.
Right. If you take the pledge that you want to take a stand against gun violence in your community and your state, you can sign up. You'll end up getting our emails. You'll get our action alerts and petitions and suggestions of when to write to your legislature and legislators and how to do it. And it's always best, obviously, for people to customize their notes, and so that legislators see that different people care, and you tell them about what you care about. But we do have a way you can put in your zip code, and if you don't know who your representatives are, because, you know, sometimes it does change with those redistricting things.
With the gerrymandering, yeah.
Yeah.
Call it what it is.
We try and do that. We're trying to give information about what's happening on the federal and state level, and just really give people those resources to find out about it and to keep talking about it.
And while it's good to go to ceasefirepa.org, I am still a fan of taking a pen, writing on a piece of paper, signing your name on the bottom, putting it in an envelope, putting a stamp on it, and sitting it on their desk. They do hold on to those, and it's going to help out our post office.
I think that's right. And also, you know, picking up the phone and calling. They will ask you what your zip code is, where you're from, and they do track it. You know, we hear from them, you know, when they're hearing from people that care about what we care about, or we hear when they're getting calls, a lot of calls from the other side. So it is really important not to let up that pressure or that encouragement, or just to say thank you to somebody who's, you know, made a statement or said something in the paper or come out in support of something that you care about.
Absolutely. Sure, Goodman, I appreciate the time. Executive Director of Ceasefire PA, ceasefirepa.org, the website. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Sure, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death, no one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The wall came down. They'd all be warm. But the wall came down.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. I don't know if you saw over the weekend this sinkhole that swallowed up a Florida man. They called off the search. Said, well, we don't think we're ever going to find him. 60 feet deep, they said at one point. And you go, this guy's sleeping in his bed, and all of a sudden the ground just opens up. And they're saying that, you know, in Florida they have these sinkholes because of the bedrock is very porous. And what happens, they say, is you get the acidic rainwater that gets into the ground, dissolves the rock, causing erosion, and you know, bang, you know, it just opens up. And you go, well, that's kind of almost what happens here. We have rainwater that doesn't get moved along because, understand, we've had 41 sinkholes in the last year. Gets underground because we're not, in my view, you know, moving the water the right way. I mean, you look at the Harrisburg area that gets flooded the way it does. You're not doing, because we've got 120-year-old infrastructure. You've had the build-up over all these years. Nowhere for it goes. It goes underground. It erodes away, and bang, sinkhole. Swallowed up, what? Swallowed up, almost swallowed up a garbage truck, and then the next, I think a day or two later, almost swallowed up a backhoe. And I look at this and I go, you know, it's a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're just not investing in our infrastructure. I mean, the thing in Florida, as tragic as it is, I'm not quite sure what the state could have done, and something we'll look into in the coming days, weeks, and months. But, you know, here with the sinkholes that we've got, upgrading our infrastructure, probably not a bad idea. Could probably save a little bit. And I look at what our governor put forth in his State of the State address, $1.8 billion over the next 5 years on what will be in 5.5 years, or in 5 years, a $6.5 billion need. That is just ludicrous and not something that I would consider leadership in any way, shape, or form, and not surprising that the some polling that's just out shows that our governor has a 68% negative job rating. 68% negative. 51% say they oppose Corbett's agenda. I mean, 51% are against what he's doing on the whole thing. I mean, then you start looking at the little bits and the little pieces. It's what he's earned. And when you find that a third of the people, a third of the voters, an entire 33%, I mean, think about this for a second, where 68% of the people, negative job approval rating, negative. 63% oppose his agenda. 51% the entire thing. Now, his budget, little bit of gray, decent area, I guess, because, you know, he hasn't hurt the voter, the likely voter, just those poor people who, unfortunately, haven't voted. And I look at this, 1 in 3 describe his tenure in office as poor. And, you know, I go back to this whole vision thing. I want leaders who are going to see the future and say, you know what, this is where I want to go. This is where I want, when I'm out of office, people to look back and go, this is what I did. And what this guy's going to be remembered for, in my view, is harming those who were the most vulnerable. Whether it was the adult basic or the kids off of Medicare or off of Medicaid, or it was the general assistant budget or the education, the slashing of education and pushing us towards really seeing a destroyed public education system. That's going to be his legacy, along with massive handouts to special interests. At a time when we should be investing heavily, and I look at this report just out by the Brookings and Rockefeller Project, who said, you know, in 2012, Amtrak saw a record number of customers, over 31 million people. A 55% increase since 1997. It is the fastest growing method of transportation in the country right now. The big money being made in the Northeast with the shots from, you know, D.C. to New York or New York up to New England or the Northeast corridor. And you've got Republicans who are just losing their minds. Hey, you're giving them some money, which is, I guess, $1.5 billion a year. We don't have a problem giving the oil industry, you know, billions of dollars, but give it to public transportation that people too much. And you look at all the money we spend on highways, all the money we spend on the FAA, and, well, not so much on mass transit, on public transportation, where I think we could be investing heavily. But again, it comes down to will. You look at when the president wanted to have high-speed rail, all the Republican governors who stood in the way. That vision I keep talking about, and the people who lack it. You look at the money that we've given away, and we've spent, money we've given away to Big Oil, happy birthday, 100th anniversary, and the money we've spent on the Highway Trust Fund, more than $50 billion, more than we've spent on Amtrak in its entirety. There's something wrong here. Let's take a quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Politicians spent most of the weekend trying to shift blame for who was responsible for a series of drastic cuts that went into effect on Friday, known as the sequester. President Barack Obama was required to sign the $85 billion in cuts, and as he did, he called them dumb and arbitrary. The impact of the cuts will likely be felt for months and could be inflamed as Congress gears up for a budget debate this month. The president said he isn't interested in making deals month by month, a strategy that has been aggressively employed by the Republican House over the last 4 years, but is instead seeking a long-term but balanced approach. to the intensity of the sequester fallout will depend on where one lives. Here's a roundup of what different regions are projecting. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Sunday that his state is already feeling the impact of the sequester, and a great deal of that is the psychological fallout from political brinkmanship. The direct impact in New York will include a loss of $42.7 million for primary and secondary education. That could see 590 teachers and aides out of work. Nearly 4,300 children will be impacted by necessary cuts to Head Start programs. Seniors in the state will lose out in nearly $1.5 million in meals. Pennsylvania is losing $37.5 million in federal funding to a number of housing programs. Loss of funding to one Pennsylvania program, the Tenant-Based Rental Assistance Program, will directly affect more than 4,000 families. In Wisconsin, $10.1 million in federal funding is being lost in the state's Education for Children with Disabilities program. That state's university system will likely lose $35 million in research funding. California will see $62.9 million slashed from special education programs. 10,000 college work-study programs will be lost. The unemployed will also be hit with a setback in the quest for gainful employment, as $3 million in unemployment support will be eliminated.
The AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today released a joint statement on shared principles concerning immigration reform. Those principles include that Americans should have first crack at available jobs, but that laws permit businesses to hire foreign workers without going through a cumbersome and inefficient process to do it when needed. The Labor Federation and the Chamber say the challenge is to create a mechanism that responds to the needs of business while also fully protecting the wages and working conditions of U.S. and immigrant workers. The two organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but their joint statement says the nation needs to fix the immigration system in part by establishing a professional bureau in a federal executive agency with political independence to inform Congress and the public about immigration issues.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. I stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in the wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the numbers are coming in. You look at the fact that the student debt bubble being blown up every day exceeded $1 trillion this year from what reports are saying. And you know, I saw in the President's State of the Union, he said, you know, we need to have universal preschool for everyone. We need to get people educated because, you know, that's the direction the country needs to go. We need educated folks. And I remember the next day on fake news on Fox, you had one of the commentators who, in talking about the president's plan to make sure that kids get a good start in life, had this to say.
I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it, we can't afford it. To say preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that.
We don't have the money for it. Yet the next day I saw a story, Stanford University raised $1 billion for their endowment. So the question is, do we not have the money or do we not have the will to make sure that every kid gets an education K through 12 and on into college? And this bubble, what's it doing to the next generation? Which is why I've asked Scott Ross of One Wisconsin Now. He was one of the presenters at the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit this weekend. It's just another one of those things that I really wanted to go to, which is why we've asked Scott to come on the program. Scott, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, thank you so much for the kind invitation.
You know, I look at this bubble that's being blown up that even my generation, and I'm only 45, we weren't saddled with this kind of debt. I talk to kids in their 20s and in their 30s, and they're going, man, I am just weighted down. I can't even buy a car for the love of Pete.
Well, yeah, and I mean, we did some original research on, you know, things like that, middle-class purchasing, like home ownership, like new car purchasing. And the results were absolutely shocking and should be frightening for anybody who is interested in America digging its way out of the economic depression that we were in and moving forward with a strong middle class.
But here again, what we're looking at is we're looking at the selling of the next generation down the road, and we're seeing it in just about every aspect of life, you know, be it on the job or be it in the classroom or in the tax world.
Well, I think so, and I think that the, you know, with in particular with student loan debt, it is this trillion-dollar debt crisis. It's a confluence of all the failed economic policies that pro-corporate conservatives have been trying to sell the United States for the last 30 years that over and over again have failed the middle class. And this student loan debt is literally, we believe, the next third rail of American politics. And as more and more young people try and go out in the workforce and are unable to get their slice of the American dream because directly attributable to student loan debt, you know, maybe now is the time when something will finally get done about it.
Yeah, I remember I brought this up about 5 years ago because I had been reading the tea leaves and reading people's reports going, this is coming, start paying attention. And I did. And I remember having conversations with people who said, you know, my age and a little bit older said, well, you know, I had to have debt. I had to take out a loan to get an education. Why should they get it free when I didn't?
Well, I think the thing is, and you know, it's understandable because, you know, a lot of this stuff happened with little fanfare. But what we have to acknowledge, recognize, and change is the fact that privatization was introduced into the student loan system in the 1990s, in the mid-1990s. And from there, Wall Street and the banks were able to lobby a pliant Congress to take away literally every consumer protection for student loan debt that is afforded every other commercial transaction.
Right.
And that is why we believe, you know, we believe that one of the reasons that student loan debt has grown so vast is because, you know, parents weren't and students weren't really told about the kind of system they were entering.
We were all told, Scott, this is the way to the middle class. The only path to that middle class existence that my grandparents, who barely had an eighth grade education, were able to attain, the only way I was going to get there was a college education.
And absolutely. And what's despicable about the current messaging on this, when you do hear conservatives talk about student loan debt, is, well, maybe some students shouldn't go to college. Maybe you should just go for, you know, a year or so and get, you know, the training you need and then get out into the workforce and get these jobs that, you know, these manufacturing jobs or whatever that don't seem to exist in a lot of places, you know, every place from Pennsylvania where I grew up to Wisconsin where I live now. And the fact is that education is the pathway to a good middle-class existence. Unfortunately, we're making students become virtual indentured servants to student loan debt, and it's because Wall Street got everything that it wanted.
Yep.
The federal and state governments reduced the amount of investment they made in higher education, and the minimum wage hasn't kept up so that, you know, my mom, who worked in the Butler Mushroom Mine in the 1960s to get through college with virtually no debt, that doesn't exist anymore because, you know, if you wanted to work minimum wage, you know, to afford the tuition at the University of Wisconsin, which is over $10,000 a year and still is the lowest in of the Big Ten schools, you'd have to work nearly 10 months, you know, 40 hours a week just to have $10,000 to be able to pay that tuition under today's current minimum wage.
Excellent point. And I have a friend who is a college professor, and she said, you know, she worked her way all the way through the University of Michigan system, all the way through her undergrad and through her law degree, walked out of there back in the 60s without a dime in debt and worked as a waitress.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll
highlight exactly what you said.
You know, I'll give you a good example. Like, you know, in Wisconsin, which has the nation's oldest technical college system, until 1972, that was free. You know, students who went before 1972, you know, didn't have to pay anything.
Right.
And we have changed that because we have reduced the investment in higher education and K-12 education to pay off things like, you know, the Reagan tax cuts from the 1980s, the Bush tax cuts from the 2000s, and two wars that were put on the credit card.
Yeah, and you brought up Reagan. To me, most of this really, I mean, some of it started before pre-Reagan, but it was really pedal to the metal during the Reagan years. And especially, I go back to when he was governor of California. California universities used to be free until he came along and changed that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we saw, you know, with the tax breaks that began to be doled out in the Reagan years. I mean, we saw the corporate income tax cut rate be cut by a third. We saw the top personal income tax rate, you know, cut by over 50%. And we simply don't have money because our elected officials, those in power, are allowing rich people to get away without paying what their fair share should be in a progressive tax system. It's as simple as that.
And what we're seeing right before our very eyes, to use one of my Tea Party friends' favorite terms, is we're seeing redistribution of wealth of epic proportions.
Absolutely. And again, it's the middle class that has to pay the bill. Because it's the middle class, that's, you know, it's middle class students who are being saddled with this student loan debt. And, you know, one of the shocking figures that we found in our survey, and this was a survey of 2,700 people, people with student loan debt, people without student loan debt, people of all income strata, was that if you have a student loan debt, you are two-thirds more likely to buy a used car than a new car. If you have a student loan debt, you are two-thirds more likely to be a renter than own your own home. And in fact, what we found, this shocking statistic, in the state of Wisconsin, people, you know, 86% of people earning between $50,000 and $75,000 a year, which is a good salary, 86% of those renters, of people who are renting as opposed to owning, have a student loan debt.
And the other part of this is they can, even if you're making $20,000 or $10,000 a year, it can't be discharged. You're saddled with it, and it keeps growing and growing, even if you can't pay.
Yeah, there is literally, I mean, there's no statute of limitations. I was at a conference right before I went to the one out in Pennsylvania, and one of the guys was talking about basically we treat student loan debt the same way in terms of statute of limitations. You treat treason and murder. You know, those are the three things that you cannot, you know, the statute of limitations simply does not in any way, shape, or form have an end date to. And, you know, when we think about what businesses are allowed to do and what wealthy people are allowed to do,
yep.
And then you think about, you juxtapose that with what the student loan rules are. For instance, you know, I consolidated my student loans back in 2000. And unfortunately, the rate at that point in time was 7.875%. Less than a year later, interest rates were 1.99%. I am forbidden by law from being able to reconsolidate my loan. All student loan people are unable to, you know, refinance their student loans as the market rates fluctuate. So a lot of us are paying, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% when interest rates are, you know, virtually zero at this point in time.
But Scott,
it is a national crisis.
But Scott, that's good business. Come on, that's good for business.
Well, I tell you what, I thought what was good for business was people spending their hard-earned money in their communities to buy goods and services in local communities. I thought that good business was young people getting out of college with the entrepreneurial spirit to be able to create small businesses that employ 5, 6, 10, 15 people. But our students are being unable to do that because the average length of debt for a bachelor's degree now is 18.7 years of paying that off. And when you think about the average student loan debt being about $350 a month, you are paying so much more than anybody paid, you know, before, you know, and again, before privatization, before the Wall Street banks got all the rules they wanted, so that our students don't have any rights, essentially.
Now, see, that used to be how business operated. Well, my grandparents' generation were in charge of things. That was the idea, what you laid out. This is the new America, Scott. We don't believe those things. We don't believe those things anymore.
Well, I think a lot of people believe them. Unfortunately, you know, there's not enough shows like yours where people are talking about things that are affecting the middle class. You know, we have talking heads screaming at each other, you know, basically, you know, well, should we make a tax cut for the rich people this percent or should it be this percent? You know, we don't think about the middle class, and that is the engine that drives our American economy. It drives it in Wisconsin. It drives it in Pennsylvania. It drives it all over this country. High-wage jobs create a good, strong economy. A good, strong middle class makes America thrive. And
yep.
That's what we need to get back to.
I'm with you. But beyond all of that, beyond all of the good economic part of it, to me, is the citizens. I want educated, critical thinking citizens so that we don't end up in the position we're in now. And, you know, I find the more educated we become, you know, as my grandfather always said, because he was a street smart guy, never finished eighth grade. The more education you get, the dumber we seem to get.
Well, it's just a matter of, you know, whether or not we allow ourselves to lapse into a debtor's envy.
Good point.
And that's what concerns me. We've got all these young people coming out of college, you know, and let's not kid ourselves. Like, we have been divided on issues late in elections by things like race and LGBT issues. And as our, you know, Generation X is more enlightened than the baby boomers are on that, and the millennials are more enlightened than Generation X. And instead of these divisive issues being able to keep people from focusing on what their economic needs are, you know, we're going to squander the fact that the young people can't be divided on those issues. They can focus on these things. And they're going to be concerned about the fact that they have 20 and 30 years of student loan debt. It's going to program them to be more selfish, unfortunately, about their neighbors, about the community, and about the investment, because they're saying, well, for God's sakes, I've got a 20-year student loan, you know, that I'm paying $400 a month for because I wanted simply to get an education, and I'm being told it's my fault.
Yeah. So what do we do, Scott? I mean, you know, at the end of this, there's got to be a policy where we can turn some of this around and really save it for my kids, because, you know, I don't want my kids to be in that situation. Their college is, you know, 10 years down the road. You know, we throw some money into these 529 plans, which I don't think are going to be enough. And I think a lot of it has to do with a nice tax shelter for the wealthy. What should we be doing? How should this look? How should we be educating our kids?
First of all, there are several prongs to this, and we're not going to solve the problem overnight. What we got to do is we've got to lobby Congress to make sure that we treat student loans the same way we treat business loans. And that is to give the consumers real protection. We need to insist on our state and federal government that they finance higher education according to the cost of higher education today. And lastly, we need to make sure that the priority of government is doing what the vast majority of people need, which is to invest in the public infrastructure and job creation, so that when our young people get out of college, they have real jobs and a chance at the American dream.
Sounds good to me. Last question I've got for you, one of the shocking things that I've heard, and I just wanted to hear you repeat it. You know, we think about student loan debt as something only for, you know, the recent college graduates or, you know, the recently unemployed. But I heard a statistic on the number of seniors who had their Social Security garnished. Any idea what that number was?
Yeah, we had last year 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. And in fact, if you look at percentages of debt acquisition, it's people over the age of 60 whose percentage of debt has grown the most over the last 7 years. It's gone from $7 billion in 2005 to $43 billion as of 2012. So it is a multi-generational crisis, and anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students; it's about all of us.
Absolutely, absolutely, Scott Ross. I appreciate the time. One Wisconsin Now. Thanks so much,
Rick. Thank you. Anytime.
Alrighty, great. I appreciate it. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Oh, 90% of the world. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The word of the day is boom. Yes, boom times are upon us again. The stars came into alignment, marveled one financial manager. Corporate confidence returns, applauded a recent headline. We're finally dusting off the cobwebs, rejoiced a business analyst, pointing out that banks are willing to take risks. Well, it's about time that bankers and CEOs began turning loose of some of the trillions of dollars they've been hoarding. Since the crash of 2008, Grassroots America has been starved of investment and job-creating enterprises. So any sign of that long-dormant capital finally beginning to move would be splendid news indeed. Except for this nagging question. Where's the money going? Hint, not to you. The big money is not being invested in job growth, grassroots enterprise, new products, or anything else that would improve your family's economic prospects. Rather, this boom is truly explosive. A job-destroying financial flimflam known grandly as the corporate merger. It amounts to nothing more than one giant corporation taking over another, or even a corporation taking over itself. The mega merger is back, exclaimed the New York Times. I'll say. Already this year, $11 billion was spent to merge U.S. Air into American Airlines. Warren Buffett and a Brazilian buyout group threw $23 billion into the purchase of ketchup peddler H.J. Heinz. And Michael Dell amassed $24 billion to buy his namesake computer outfit, which he already was in charge of and owned the biggest chunk of. This is Jim Hightower saying, this buyout boom is a boon to the financial hucksters and top executives who profit from the deals, but merger mania cuts jobs, shrinks competition, raises consumer prices, concentrates wealth in fewer hands, and diverts capital from productive enterprises. What a deal for America! Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Look, we know in days like yesterday and today, we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
Gotta love all the financial mumbo jumbo. And you know, one of the things that gets me about what Scott Ross was talking about is how well they have done this over the years. You know, I go back, and we were talking about it when I was in college back in the 80s, and you know, the debt that I had, you know, you had to pay it back, and you knew you had to pay it back, but it was nowhere in the neighborhood of what these kids are saddled with today, and the wages were considerably higher. And I went back to, you know, when I got out of college. I took a job working for a trucking company, throwing boxes on a shipping dock, making $15 an hour as a casual. And you look at what they're being paid today to do the same job. Someone told me it was like $12 an hour. And this isn't adjusted for inflation. This is back in the late 80s, I was making $15 an hour. They're not making that now. Almost a quarter of a century forward. And you look at this, and I go back to my friend who's the professor who said, you know, he worked her way through law school on tips at a local diner there in Michigan. Those days are long gone. And I don't know what kind of, you know, part-time job you get that's going to do that. It can't be legal. And I look at this debt crisis that we've created, and we have created this by pushing it down on the next generation. You look at the statistic I saw, what was it, 15% of the K-12 funding comes from the state, which is it used to be at one point it was 50%. So you look at the redistribution that's going on right before our very eyes, all because we've got politicians who say, well, at least we didn't raise taxes, and take great pleasure in saying we gave huge tax breaks to the well-to-do instead of investing. But again, I go back and I think about, you know, what conservative world looks like. And a lot of this really, really accelerated during the Reagan years. It was all there. There was a push for it. The business class wanted education. If you go back and you read the Powell memo, and I had an interesting conversation with someone over the weekend about the Powell memo, because, you know, he was one of these guys, well, you know, that was the definitive piece. I'm going, he was one of many that wrote similar type plans. He was just happened to become a Supreme Court justice, which is what gave it such strong weight. But if you look at those plans, it was all taking over education. It was taking over the message at a young age, and they've done a masterful job of taking over higher ed and convincing high school kids that you got to go to college. And parents have convinced their kids, you know, you can't work with your hands because those jobs are going away. And I think back to my grandfather telling me, you know, if you become a truck driver like me, you'll have been a failure because you have the opportunity to go to college. You have the opportunity that I never had, he said. He goes, he couldn't even finish eighth grade because he had to go to work to put food on the table. I mean, you think about that generation who lived the hard life, lived the street life, fought for what it is that we're now giving away. That's what infuriates me to no end. They fought those battles so we wouldn't have to. And yet here we are going, here, no problem. Privatize public education. Yes. Because we don't want our taxes raised? Are you really kidding me on that? And the accelerator on privatizing education is the pension fund now. They went and they screwed up the pension fund, something that has been viable for over 100 years. And now they're saying, well, we need to do to public education what private industry has done to industry after industry, which is bankrupt it. Cut it off. Let's move to a different entity. And this is what happens when you have business people sitting in the halls of government. Because they don't mind running things. And I thought Scott made an interesting point. You know, the wealthy, they don't have problems with filing bankruptcy or using maneuvers to shed debt. That's no problem for them. For you and me, they make it seem like, well, it's the end of the world. And we've been told numerous times, well, you know, you're a failure then. Well, it doesn't seem to matter to these big corporate titans, does it? Not at all. And maybe, you know, and I didn't ask Scott, and I wish I would have. You know, what would happen if everyone just said, you know what? All of the folks who are paying 7, 8, 9% interest said, we're not paying it. We demand to have a refinancing. If it's 1%, 1.9, 2% now, we want it at that rate. We want to have those consumer protections, and we're not doing anything until you do. But again, that would take a movement of people willing to stand up and say no more. And I think back to, you know, the founding of this country, and I'm waiting for that moment again. Now, we keep hearing the voices on the right say, well, if you raise taxes, there's going to be a revolution. I'm waiting to see the real revolution when working people realize that for the last 30 years, they've been getting the shaft. For the last 30 years, policy has gone against them. We have catered to the ultra-wealthy at the expense of our kids' futures. And I, for one, don't want to see my kids saddled with tens or $100,000 worth of debt. I knew a guy, him and his wife, when she was an attorney. He had a PhD. They were each $100,000 in debt. They're, you know, they make a reasonable living, but when you're talking about starting off your marriage as young graduates, $200,000 in the hole, it's ludicrous. What good to our society does that do? And the answer is none. What it does is it harms their productive years, the years that they would be buying a home and buying cars and furniture and all the things that go with being a young startup couple. You've taken them out. And how is that good for our economy? What we're doing is we're taking future spending on that middle class Norman Rockwell existence that we've been sold, and we're handing it over to bankers. And the bankers are ticked that the Obama administration said, well, we're gonna have a federal program for that. Because that profit, really, they want. They lobbied heavily for that. That's theirs. And they're going to fight tooth and nail, you mark my word, to get it back. And one of the other things that I should have asked, and we're going to get Scott back again to talk about this issue, because where do we go? I've seen studies say that, I've seen ideas, and again, I go back to Milton Friedman. It's the ideas that are lying around that we use in times of crisis, whether it's, you know, it's self-created or it's something that's natural. When this student loan bubble bursts and enough people say enough, we're not paying it, what then? How do we make sure that the next generation gets an education? And I'd heard a good idea. So, you know what? You're going to pay a percentage of your income for X amount of years, and whatever that income is, that's what you're going to pay. If you make $20,000 a year, or if you make $20 million a year, you're going to pay that percentage into a fund. That fund is going to fund education, and at a certain point, it becomes self-sustaining to where we now have a source of revenue coming in that is directly funding education. This seems like a reasonable idea to me. There's an X amount of time. This way we get people going into maybe a less lucrative. Maybe we don't have a whole bunch of Wall Street greedmongers. Maybe we got people who want to take care of kids in the local neighborhood or take care of my grandmother. Or who knows? Maybe do community organizing and could be president someday. Because even the president doesn't make a whole lot of money. He will when he leaves. But while in office, not so much. There's so much we should be doing, and yet here we are, still talking about the same divisive issues that they've stuck in our face. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Here we are. Day one, here, the first Monday of being popeless. We are absolutely popeless. And in fact, interesting story, someone tried to sneak in, like a sporting event. Someone tried to jip their way in line, pretending to be a bishop so that they could be in the little smoke event. But here we are, popeless. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Victoria, we're popeless. What are we going to do? No direct line to the man above. Or woman.
How did they know he wasn't a cardinal?
I'm not quite sure, but you know, I guess they maybe retinal scans, maybe you know. I don't even want to go there. To be honest, where my mind had just gone. He didn't know that his secret handshake, whatever that is.
Oh, I think that's a scream. Somebody tried to get in. That's so funny.
You know, like the guy who tries to fly his way into the one fight and almost got knocked out, or under the football field. Beautiful, but popeless. And what bothers
popeless
me is, you know, there was enough notice. He gave his 2 week notice. They could have found somebody else. They could have been doing this all along.
You know, he didn't give any notice. He didn't give much notice.
I think
for a job like that, you've got to give a bit of notice. It's not union.
But he still gave notice, and they should have been working on it instead of just starting today. We'll get around to it. You know, we had to get our robes clean.
Yeah.
Had to find some white smoke.
No, the white smoke's easy. It's the black smoke that they add the chemical to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there you go. So what are the inside bets? Who are we thinking will be the next pope?
Well, there are three or four guys. But it's what they're saying is that this is really, really unpredictable.
Wow.
I mean, really unpredictable. They're thinking it could be like radical, because the people are just so ticked off at this point that that they could just go in almost, you know, any direction, because they, some people just, they just want anything.
Yeah, but it's not going to be a woman, I'll tell you that. That's a sure bet. It's not going to be a woman.
Oh. I was betting that way. Well, there's Peter Turkson of Ghana, Leonardo Sandri of Argentina, Christoph Schoenbaum of Austria, Odilo Schurer of Brazil, Mark Uye of Canada, and Angelo Scola from Italy. These are the leading candidates.
Okay. See, now I thought Bishop Scola would be the guy, or Cardinal Scola would be the guy. This is a stupid joke my Catholic uncle told me. This way we could have Pope Scola.
Oh, gosh!
It's just the exact reaction I got out of him. And I said, you know, I would expect that from you.
Good Catholic.
Making fun of the Pope. Something wrong with that.
Shocking.
Absolutely shocking. So here we go. The House has introduced some funding after the austerity bomb went boom. Where's the House putting the money?
Well, the House is putting money in the Pentagon.
No surprise.
And in Veterans Affairs.
No surprise.
And in the FBI, border staffing, embassy security, prisons, for the Forest Service, nuclear security, things like that.
Yeah, you poor people, screw you, but we're going to make sure that we got you poor people locked up.
Yeah, they're not putting anything into special ed, I don't think,
yeah.
Or Meals on Wheels.
Oh. Oh, did you think they were going to?
No, I'm just clarifying.
Okay.
You know.
Just want to make sure that we knew already from the beginning it wasn't going to happen. And what I love is the frame, and maybe you've been talking to the right wingers all day long. Some of my right wing friends said, see, everything didn't end today. The cuts don't really matter. They're not going to hurt. Not going to hurt anybody. It happened, and nobody's squealing. That was the one line I got today.
I've been having this conversation with a number of people today, and I've been having to say, they send out letters. They have to. They're writing to unions and they're writing to people. They have to give them 30 days notice.
Yes.
So let's have this conversation in April.
Right, where the people who are going to be affected by it realize that they got the short end of the stick, and they're the ones who were balancing budgets on the backs of. Generally, the folks at the bottom end of the socioeconomic ladder.
Yes. Mind you, apparently, if you were standing in line at customs at JFK, Miami International, or a few other airports today, it wasn't pretty because they've already cut back on overtime for the customs guys.
Good. I'm in favor. Those are the people we should be making wait long in our lines, especially the guys who work at the private airports. Those are the towers that should go first. Anybody who works at the tower at these other small airports where the private jets go into, they get laid off first. Make the CEO circle a couple of times. Let's waste his time.
People at JFK are just people coming back from a vacation in Ireland.
We shouldn't be taking vacations. They should be working.
Oh, you're a Grinch today.
I'm just kind of tired of having this conversation that, you know, we're going to go and we're going to make sure that the special interests who put out the big money for campaigns, that they're going to be well taken care of. And people like me, when I was a kid growing up in a housing project, those are the people that we're going to balance budgets on the backs of. The least able to afford it and those with the least amount of voice. That's what infuriates me.
I've got nothing for you.
Nor should you. I mean, you know, that's the reality of what it is, though. It angers me. So I guess Obama's got three new choices for his cabinet. Two of them, you know, the corporates like, and one, well, not so much.
Well, yeah, one, not so much. It all depends, because basically bending over to try and pick up the story, and
well,
I can't.
Don't hurt yourself.
Up. No, well, I couldn't pick it up right, and I dropped it.
Because I don't want to hear the expletive of, oh, you know what's coming next.
No, you don't want to hear it, and I'm English, and you could hear it so easily. Ernest Moniz, to head the Department of Energy, is the one that people might have a problem with, or at least green groups might have a problem with. He's an MIT physicist, and I was in the East Room when President Obama announced him today. He's got scientist hair.
Yeah, he does. He's a strange-looking dude.
Mad hair he's got. Yes, it was fascinating. I couldn't take my eyes off him.
Yeah.
Anyway, he apparently, he's in favor of natural gas.
Pro-fracking. Pro-fracking, yep.
He may be pro-fracking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pro-solar, though, so, you know, not
hard. Pro-solar also, so he's a complicated guy.
So he's bi-energy.
Exactly.
He swings on all sides.
Gina McCarthy, who's tapped to lead the EPA, on the other hand, and is currently in charge of air at the EPA.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to be in charge of. I think it's important. Is apparently somebody that green groups like very much.
And the righties hate.
Even utilities and regulators who might oppose her say she's a straight shooter. She listens. And you know exactly where you are with her.
Well, I guess that's a good thing, because all of the press releases I saw from the right wing groups said she doesn't know how to, she shouldn't run a Burger King, and she screwed up the air quality testing after Fukushima, and you know, the fact that we've been defunding those agencies and haven't been replacing the filters or upkeeping any of the stuff, because we've lost a lot of employees. Never mind that. She should be out there doing that herself, according to the right wing groups. You know, that was the big knock against her, and that, you know, it's the coal people who hate her.
Well, I mean, I was looking at the quotes from a number of industry groups, and they were fairly tepid in their hatred of her, actually, today.
So these three should sail through. I mean, I've got a problem with this Sylvia Burwell myself, you know, having, you know, been the person who was cozied up with Walmart and now the head of OMB. I, you know, you kind of go out of wonder, right?
Well, McCarthy may have some holes put on her, actually. Even though she will go through, I'm quite sure she'll go through, but she may have some holes put on her in the same way that John Brennan's got holes put on him for CIA for things that have nothing to do with him.
Right.
She may have holes put on her because some senators on some environmental issues are gnashing their teeth over certain issues and have been for months, and are going to use this as the opportunity to get answers on issues that they've just been grinding teeth about.
Well, you know, hey, someone's got to pay the price for Obama being a socialist.
And I think it's going to be Gina McCarthy.
Well, we shall see. And it'll be interesting to watch, because, you know, you got to love a good fight. You know, and you've got to hold up his nominees all down the line, especially his judicial appointments. Got to hold those up as well, because, you know, what would a day in D.C. be without something to bicker about? I see that there's a deal in the Senate on gun trafficking.
Yes. There is. It's a bipartisan deal. Senators Mark Kirk from Illinois and Susan Collins from Maine, centrist Republicans, reached a deal with Senate Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy, Dick Durbin, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who are all Democrats. And it's on cracking down on illegal trafficking and straw purchases of guns. And basically, what it does is it strengthens the law prohibiting material false statements in connection with purchasing a gun, and it strengthens penalties for purchasing a gun with intent to transfer it to someone involved in violent crime or drug trafficking. It would also outlaw the unauthorized transfer of firearms out of the country. So it makes it very serious. It would they would be punishable by up to 25 years in prison.
Okay. Any chance of it passing the House?
I don't know. I think it's going to pass the Senate. I think this one might actually pass the House, because not only these five are interested in it, apparently Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, who is not a centrist Republican, is looking at it with some interest, too.
Huh. Well, we will see what happens. I would be surprised if it passes.
I would, too, but this is the one that seems at this point to have the most possibility of success. It's not, doesn't have anything at all to do with Newtown.
Okay, good.
But it,
But it's something.
It's something. It's something to talk about gun safety, and it would give all of the politicians a win, and maybe give them the ability to make the issue go away. Yeah,
which is what they probably like.
All right. I saw Joe Biden was talking today to the AIPAC people. Are we going to a war with Iran now?
Well, it depends.
It depends.
I think it depends partly on Netanyahu, who also spoke to AIPAC, but he spoke by satellite. Well, Biden was at great pains to say that President Obama is not bluffing. He said Obama's policy on Iran is to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Period. Period. End of discussion.
That's it.
Prevent.
End
not contain. Prevent.
And how about nuclear energy?
Well, I mean, I think that the question is, well, the P5+1 made Iran an offer that they could keep quite a controversial nuclear plant and actually have the option to have some nuclear energy if they would just stop refining uranium for weapons. And they seem to have thumbed their noses at the P5+1.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. You know, I have some friends who are looking forward to they have some defense contractor stocks. And, you know, hey, war makes people millionaires. So I've got some friends who are anxiously awaiting that.
That sounds cheerful.
It's not. Not cheerful at all. And talking about not cheerful, I saw Mittens was on TV this weekend saying it kills him not to be in the White House.
Kills him. Kills him not to be in the White House. He also says that if he were president, the sequester wouldn't have happened.
What would he have done?
Well, I'm not clear on that, actually. I wasn't clear on that when he said it. But somehow he would have averted it. Maybe he'd have put on one of those, you know, Superman costumes. He would have averted it.
Or maybe he'd have done another video.
Maybe we've done another video.
Yeah, you know, another 47% of the people are destroying the country. The those urbans, those people who get big gifts.
The people without health insurance.
Well, so everybody can't have health insurance. It's a privilege.
Well,
it's a privilege. Didn't you know, Victoria? It's a privilege in this country. And if you don't like it, you can leave. I understand Ann Romney blamed the media, the evil media.
She blamed the media, and she also admitted that she's not as flexible as she could be, and I don't think she was referring to her joints either. Yeah, she blamed the media, and, you know, it's such a cop-out, because even Romney blamed his own campaign.
And he did run a bad campaign.
He ran a bad campaign.
He ran a horrible campaign.
Yeah.
Probably the only person who could run a worse campaign would have been Dennis Rodman. And finally, I understand Dennis is back from North Korea talking about his new buddy.
Kim Jong-un. He is my friend.
My friend. Love him.
My friend. Hate me, he said.
Yeah, well, okay. There you go. Victoria, always great talking with you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561
Earth, sky.
sky.
You might have heard the saying, like a moth to a flame, to describe a fatal attraction. But why are moths attracted to flame?
The fact is, scientists think moths aren't so much attracted to the light of a flame or other bright light as they are disoriented by it. Here's how it works. Like many flying insects, moths are able to find their way partly by using light as a compass.
When the source of light is the sun or moon, that light source is very distant, and the incoming light rays that strike an insect arrive just about parallel to each other. So moths, and many other flying insects, have evolved to expect to receive light at a fixed part of their eye. As long as the moth flies more or less in a straight line, this visual pattern remains unchanged.
Now, consider what happens when the light source is a nearby street light. Then the angle at which the light strikes the moth's eye quickly changes if the moth holds to a straight line course. The moth tries to do what it's evolved to do under the light of the sun or moon, that is, maintain a constant angle to the source.
And as it does so, it spirals in toward the light, so the moth seems attracted to the light, so much so that it might end up drawn into a flame. More frequently asked science questions at earthsky.org. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Fox News alert. It's election day. We got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
What is he doing? What's he doing? What's he doing? Well, he's holding the door open for a couple of old ladies. That's what he's doing. Well, that's not news. Man, didn't show that clip again, huh? Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. A little labor history today. 1913, William Howard Taft, president at the time, signed legislation that created the Department of Labor. William B. Wilson was named the first person to head up the new department, which was to help labor. Just a thought. Franklin Roosevelt named Francis Perkins to be the first Secretary of Labor. She was the very first female cabinet member in U.S. history. Also today in 1933. And today in 1937, workers... members of the UAW workers at the General Motors plant there in Flint won their sit-down strike. They won recognition of their union. And again, you know, they go back and what did they do with sit-down strikes? They ruled them illegal. Thank you, U.S. Supreme Court. Using government as a tool. Get them out of my life! Get them out! Get them out! And you look at how our labor laws over the years have been just destroyed and decimated, and you can fire people for just about anything if you just use this at-will employment doctrine. And I just started watching this, and I've been meaning to for a long time, watching this program, House of Cards. And the one episode that I watched last night, the wife of Kevin Spacey runs like a nonprofit, the Water Initiative, I think it was called. And she wanted to fire half the staff. So she tells this woman to go in and fire all of them. And she walks in. She goes, so how did it go? How'd the firings go? And the woman goes, well, there were some tears and some, blah, blah, blah. And, we basically use the at-will employment doctrine, which got us out of any legal wranglings. And then I loved what the woman turned, what Spacey's wife, what her character, what she turned around and did. So this woman, 59-year-old woman who is the office manager, does all the dirty work, fires all these people, sends all these people packing, and then in comes Spacey's wife's character and fires her after she does all the dirty work. And I guess that there's poetic justice in that. Because, if it were me, I don't know that I could do that. It just is what it is. But you look at the nature of our labor law, and there's something seriously wrong with it, especially with this whole at-will employment doctrine. But had this Christian college in the San Diego area used the at-will employment doctrine, probably wouldn't have gotten themselves into any trouble. The problem was this young woman evidently became pregnant and showed that she was pregnant. So the administration called her in, asked her if she had had
premarital intercourse? Obviously, the answer was yes, because she wasn't married and she's pregnant, unless she was going to say some kind of divine intervention. So they claimed that, you know, she violated the school's moral code, which obviously banned premarital sex because it is a Christian college, and they canned her. And the beautiful part of this, and one that I found quite interesting about the story, and it just highlights all of the hypocrisy and the ridiculous nature of these people who run these organizations. After they fired this woman, and she said, look, I felt like I was humiliated. I felt like I was in trouble. She's pregnant. After they fired her, they offered to hire, and I can't, you can't make this up. So they fire her for being pregnant because she had premarital sex. Then they offer the job to her boyfriend. Think about that for a second. Just let that sink in for a second. They fire her for engaging in premarital goings on. But, and maybe, you know, maybe here, maybe the boyfriend didn't really, the boyfriend did it. They offer him the job. You would have to imagine, and I guess you could make the assumption, and I know what they say about assumptions, but you'd have to make some reasonable assumptions that he was involved, and that, you know, he's kind of, you know, equal. So explain to me how it is that he got offered the job and she got fired. You know, just a thought. But, you know, had the college used this at-will employment doctrine? But she said, we just don't want you here. There's no particular reason. It's not because you're a woman. It's not because you may be a minority. And it may not be because you're pregnant. We just don't want you here anymore. That probably would have gone without a lawsuit. Well, the woman has filed a lawsuit, likely under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978 that prohibits sex discrimination on the basis of pregnancy. Which, you know, I didn't know there was such a law until I saw this story. And I go, well, good, but we still don't have maternity leave either. Maybe we should be thinking about that law. But it just blows my mind. And I went back and I was thinking about my years growing up. And when I read the story, she was pregnant. I guess the first question I had was, had she had an abortion, would they have known? And then could she have kept her job? Because, I mean, there is another message being sent there as well beyond that. But I remember back to seventh grade. And in seventh grade, our teacher was Sister Mary St. Leo, who hated me with a passion. And to be honest, the feeling was mutual. Because she was evil and sadistic and repressed and pent up and all of those things that I despise in a nun. It was about just before Christmas, where it looked like Sister was gaining weight. And over Christmas break, she went off to print Bibles at the mission, which I later learned was Catholic for pregnant. So I guess she got fired back then. I always wondered whatever happened to her. So that I could go back and share a little bit of my experience with her. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher. Take the program on the go. Questions, comments, something on your mind, something I said got under your skin, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial.